You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio, to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio, Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University and author of Beyond the Laboratory, Scientists as Political Activists in 1930s America. He's co-author with Akira Kimura of Rethinking the Atomic Bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japanese and American Perspectives. He's co-author with Yuki Tanaka of Nuclear Power and Hiroshima, The Truth Behind the Peaceful Use of Nuclear Power, and co-editor with James Gilbert of Rethinking Cold War Culture. In 1995, he founded American University's Nuclear Studies Institute, which he directs. In 2003, Kuznick organized a group of scholars, writers, artists, clergy, and activists to protest the Smithsonian's celebratory display of the Enola Gay. Kuznick and filmmaker Oliver Stone co-authored the book and the 12-part Showtime documentary film series, The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Hi, David. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. I think you were on just when The Untold History of the United States was coming out, and now I'm very pleased to say you'll be speaking and showing an episode of that series at a conference being planned for September at World Beyond War, which I work with, and people can go to worldbeyondwar.org and see all the wonderful speakers planned for this conference in Washington, D.C. in September, including Peter Kuznick and a screening of an episode of The Untold History of the United States. So we are very much looking forward to that.
Well, David, since we spoke of the documentary and the book were first appearing, the book has now been a bestseller on three continents. We also produced the Concise Untold History of the United States. The original book was 800 pages, and we did the Concise Untold History of the United States based on the documentary scripts. We've got volume one of four volumes of our Young Readers book coming out for middle school students. That's being translated into languages all over the world. The book is actually out in, I think, 18 languages now, and we've got a graphic novel on the way. So Oliver and I have been traveling across the United States and many other parts of the world in order to support this project and to do as much educating as we can. And one of our big themes has always been the question of the atomic bombings in 1945. When we go to campuses around the country, we show that episode more often than any other episode. And I'm glad to say, because of my efforts and your efforts and my colleagues' efforts, the latest CBS News poll for the first time shows that a plurality of Americans actually say the atomic bombings in 1945 were a mistake, were not justified. The latest CBS News poll has 44% of Americans disapproving the atomic bombing and 43% supporting it. That's never happened before. And among younger Americans, the percentage is even higher in disapproval. So we're finally making some headway on this most fundamental of American myths.
And do you credit that to the proliferation of your work and the work of other historians and scholars putting the facts out there and getting them into television documentaries and so forth? Because my impression of President Obama's relatively recent trip to Hiroshima, which made big news headlines, was that the news coverage was not actually all that helpful or fact-based.
The news coverage, for the most part, was problematic. And Obama's speech was even more problematic. Obama says during that speech, and I was in Hiroshima for that, NHK, Japan's public broadcaster, brought me over to do some television shows, and I did an enormous number of interviews around this topic, mostly with Japanese media, Chinese media, Russian media, German, British, very rarely with the U.S. media. And Obama, you know, we have to give him credit. It's good that he went to Hiroshima. It's good that after 71 years, an American president had the courage to go to Hiroshima. By doing so, he focused world's attention on nuclear issues, which have largely fallen off the radar, so it's very good that he did that. It's good that when he was there in his speech, he mentioned the Korean Hibakusha, the Korean victims of the atomic bombing, who often get overlooked. The Korean government actually asked him to stop at the Korean Memorial on his walk from the Peace Museum to the cenotaph, where he laid the wreath of flowers and made his remarks. He didn't do that, but at least he mentioned the Korean victims. It's good that he mentioned that Hiroshima broadcast the fact, it demonstrated that mankind possessed the means to destroy itself. That's an important thing that's overlooked, that Harry Truman, on at least three separate occasions before the bomb was dropped, said that this could be the beginning of the end, that he understood that he was beginning a process that could end all life on the planet, yet he proceeded to use the bomb, despite the fact that there was no military reason for doing so and no moral justification for doing so. But we'll get back to that. But so there was a lot of positives to Obama's going there. But if we look at the actual content of what he said and the things that he did while he was there, the reality is that on balance, Obama had a chance to achieve greatness with this speech. He had a chance to finally deserve the Nobel Peace Prize that he won, largely because of his speech in Prague in 2009, in which he called for nuclear abolition. And he had a chance to finally deserve it. But unfortunately, from my perspective, Obama snatched potential mediocrity from the jaws of greatness. He had a chance to really do something stupendous in Hiroshima, and he chose not to do that.
Let me play a devil's advocate a little bit, Peter Kuznick. Is it possible that, as is my view, he may have actually snatched defeat, not just mediocrity, but he may have done more harm than good?
I was going to say I think he really did do more harm than good.
Okay.
He did more harm in concretely in the present, and he also did more harm in terms of our understanding of the history. What he says there, he says, we have a shared responsibility to look directly into the eye of history. He also says, we can tell our children a different story. And what is the story he ends up telling? He says that the World War reached its brutal end in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That is the fundamental myth of the Pacific War, that the atomic bombs were necessary to force Japanese surrender, that by dropping the atomic bombs, the United States avoided an invasion of a Japanese homeland, that the United States had invaded, 500,000 American troops would have been killed in the invasion, Truman says, and millions of Japanese would have been killed. Thereby, effectively, the United States atomic bombing was humane because it saved not only 500,000 American lives, but it saved millions of Japanese lives. Therefore, it's justifiable. This is not only entirely wrongheaded, but it lies at the heart of the whole notion of American exceptionalism, which has been the driving force behind so many of the reckless policies that the United States has embraced around the world. So, but Obama, before he went there, made clear that he was not going to do two things. One, he was not going to apologize. The second, he was not going to relitigate or discuss the decision to drop the bomb. And this is part of a pattern that we've seen with Obama, to me, a very corrosive pattern. When he went to Vietnam prior to visiting Japan on this trip, they announced beforehand that the United States was not going to discuss the history of the Vietnam War. The upshot of his visit to Vietnam was that the United States was now going to sell arms to Vietnam. So after our execrable, our miserable history with Vietnam, our invasion of Vietnam, and Robert McNamara told my students that he accepts that 3.8 million Vietnamese died in that war, 3.8 million.
Not counting Laotians and...
Cambodians, Brits, Aussies. Many people have been, many of your listeners have been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C.
Right.
It's two black slabs with the names of 58,280 Americans who died in the war. It's very powerful. And the message is that the tragedy of Vietnam is that 58,280 Americans died. That wall is 492 feet long. If it contained the names of the 3.8 million Vietnamese, the more than a million Cambodians, Laotians, everybody who died in that wall would be more than 8 miles long. That would be a fitting and appropriate memorial to the Vietnam, to the U.S. invasion of Vietnam, to the Vietnam War.
Indeed.
But again, our treatment of history is so myopic, so narrow-minded, that we don't begin to even understand that. So Obama goes to Vietnam and doesn't discuss the war there. Then he goes to Hiroshima, and he reinforces the myths. Right? So he goes there, and he says that the war came to its brutal end. You know, and he makes. But if you look at that speech and you dissect that speech, it was a lie from the very first sentence. In that first sentence, he says that death fell from the sky and the world was changed. In the second sentence, he says, we come to ponder a terrible force unleashed in a not-so-distant past. Death didn't fall from the sky. A terrible force was not unleashed. The United States dropped an atomic bomb on those people. Where does he take that responsibility? Where does he put it in an active voice rather than a passive voice? And the speech is riddled with those kinds of lies, basically.
Yeah, the way that I see a problem with that speech as someone who wants to get rid of the entire institution of war is that later in that speech, he excuses himself. He denies all responsibility for anyone who makes war with the pretense that war is permanent and inevitable and has been with us since the rising of the first man, as he puts it, and that preparing for war and militarism is defensive against evil. And as long as there's going to be evil, we must prepare for more wars and build more weapons. And he wishes we could have a world where you didn't have to build more nuclear weapons, but we don't. And that lie that, you know, that war has been around as long as the species and is just natural and inevitable,
right,
seems
human
to me
nature,
to excuse.
Human nature, it's not his responsibility. It's not U.S. responsibility. It's not the responsibility of other malign forces around the world. Is somehow deeply rooted in our nature. And,
right.
And the fact that he went to Vietnam and did that, and he says there, he calls again for nuclear abolition in the abstract. And he says, we may not realize this goal in my lifetime. Why not in his lifetime? Why not in his presidency? There's no reason why this can't be done, except that he doesn't have the will, the courage, the vision to do that. You know, the atomic bomb survivors, the Hibakusha, have dedicated their lives to one principle, and that's to make sure that no Hiroshimas and Nagasakis ever occur again. And their goal is that they want to see nuclear weapons eliminated in their lifetime. Obama's a young man. This should have happened in his lifetime. This should have happened during his presidency. But in going there, not only, as you were suggesting, does he not advance the cause of nuclear abolition, he actually makes nuclear war more fightable.
Yeah.
Not only did he not announce unilateral cuts in America's nuclear arsenal, but he didn't announce a rollback in the U.S. trillion-dollar modernization program that's going to occur over the next 30 years, or in the nuclear policies that are going to persist for the next 70 years. And so Obama actually, by modernizing every single weapon in the American nuclear arsenal, is making nuclear weapons more usable. He's making nuclear war more likely. And that's the specific upshot of his trip.
Yeah,
in addition to the fact that he was going there to support Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, one of the most dangerous leaders on the planet today, who has been militarizing Japan, ripped up the Japanese peace constitution, Article 9, one of the good things to come out of World War II. He's abrogated that. He's increasing Japanese arms sales. He's imposed security laws that are opposed by the overwhelming majority of the Japanese people. He's doubling down on the U.S. base in Okinawa. And what happened as a result of Obama's trip and embrace of Abe? Abe's popularity jumped 7% in advance of the elections coming up this summer. Yeah. And Obama has, again, reinforced his Asia pivot, his containment policy of China as a result. So his speech, while the Japanese people welcomed his visit to Hiroshima, 98% according to one poll, and the survivors welcomed his visit also. The survivors who I met with and spoke with were very disappointed with what he said, what he didn't say, and what he did when he was there. The way the entire thing was stagecraft and carefully manipulated, which I can go into if you'd like, the way the whole thing was staged was to make sure that Obama did not actually deal with the survivors or in any way understand what they were trying to tell him.
Peter, the New York Times reported recently that Obama had eliminated fewer nuclear weapons than any previous president since there have been nuclear weapons. And yet he's, by many people's view, given better speeches than any other recent president, and did a photo op with the victims and went to the location, which you call courageous, and most people call courageous. But I wonder whether we really should be praising him when the rhetoric and the photo ops seem to millions of people to excuse the actions, which are not just mediocre, but worse than his predecessors.
His track record, and it's so sad. I mean, that's why I say this is a man who's snatch mediocrity from the jaws of greatness. I mean, many of us really did want to believe that he was going to be a different kind of president, especially coming after George W. Bush, right? This simple-minded warmonger who, you know, with this Christian sense of certainty, goes and invades country after country in the most flagrant and mendacious way. And then we have Obama, who's intelligent, articulate, seems to embrace a certain vision. We wanted to believe that he was an opponent of war, and he's been a real disappointment. As Ari Fleischer, Bush's former press spokesman, assured the Bush people, said, "Don't worry, Obama's second term is really the fourth term of George W. Bush." You know, and in so many ways, I mean, in many ways it's not exactly, but in too many ways it's close to being that. But again, you look at his what he did there. The first thing he did is he went to the Atomic Bomb Museum. I've been taking my students there for more than 20 years now. I began taking students on a study abroad trip to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, my class, American University, back in 1995. We've done that every summer since. And your listeners can join us because it's open to everybody who'd like to attend. And it's an amazing experience. And my students, when they go to Hiroshima, are so moved, as I was. The first time I went to Hiroshima in 1995, I was just, you know, I really couldn't find the words to express it. Such a powerful experience for an American to be there. And my students react the same way. But Obama's speech was written in advance. Obama, who's very articulate, could have easily talked about what it meant to him personally to be there. He went to the Atomic Bomb Museum first. It's under reconstruction, so they assembled artifacts for him to see. And nowhere does he even talk about what that meant to him. Then he goes and lays the wreath, and he doesn't talk about his own feelings about being in Hiroshima at all. And then he shakes hands with two hibakusha. The first one is Tsuboi-san. Tsuboi is a very nice fellow, 91 years old, from Hiroshima, who announced beforehand, as the head of Nihon Hidankyo in Hiroshima, that he doesn't expect or want Obama to apologize. That was not the view of most members of Nihon Dankyo, or the survivors in general. So Obama goes and shakes hands with him as perfunctory, and then he goes over and he shakes hands with Mori-san. And Mori is an outlier. He's persona non grata with the other Hibakusha in Hiroshima. He spent his life apologizing for the American POWs who were killed in the bombing or subsequently killed by the survivors of the atomic bombing. That's his big mission in life. And he doesn't talk about the Japanese victims, the American responsibility. He's America's greatest friend. He was invited by the United States, not by the city of Hiroshima. And so then he breaks down and Obama embraces him, and the visuals are great. But if anybody who knows the backstory knows that there were two other Hibakusha who were also invited by the city of Hiroshima, Tanaka-san and Iwasa-san. They are much more militant, much more outspoken, demanding not only apologies, but that words speak louder than actions. And they wanted to see Obama actually announce concrete steps toward nuclear abolition while he was there in Hiroshima. They were placed in the third row, in a position where, as Tanaka-san said to me, it was impossible for them to even lean in and talk to Obama. So even that was very carefully orchestrated in order to create a certain kind of visual, but not to actually give Obama the experience of listening to the Hibakusha or learning from them. One of the things that many of us demanded was that that Obama speak with all the Hibakusha who wanted to speak to him. He first went to Iwakuni Air Base, to the American base there, and met with the American troops there and with the members of the Japanese self-defense forces. Spent more time at Iwakuni shaking the hands of the American soldiers than he did in Hiroshima meeting with the survivors or learning from that. And so you know, for me, this was very, very frustrating. Frustrating in the sense that there is so much that Americans need to learn about the atomic bombing. How much do Americans know about the attitude of America's top military leaders? How many Americans know that the United States had 8 5-star officers in 1945, 7 of whom are on record saying that they thought the atomic bombs were either militarily unnecessary, morally reprehensible, or both? Right? 7 of the 8th have said that. And the 8th, General Marshall, says that the Soviet invasion by itself might well have levered the Japanese into surrender. So even though he hasn't said that the atomic bombs were explicitly unnecessary, he's challenged the official mythology that the bombs ended the war.
Peter, might not having told Japan it could keep its emperor alone have leveraged Japan into...
That could have done it, and General MacArthur, who's certainly no pacifist, right, wanted to use atomic bombs in Korea. MacArthur says the Japanese would have surrendered in May, months earlier, if we had told them they could keep the bomb, and they would have been happy to surrender.
Keep the emperor.
I think the schedule's a little too optimistic, but I think June they would have surrendered, and almost certainly in July, if we had told them that they could keep the emperor, that we had this incredible weapon, and that the Soviets were about to come into the war. That's what they dreaded. And Truman knew that that's what they dreaded. And when he got the assurance from Stalin at Potsdam that the Soviets were coming to the war, he writes in his diary that night, Stalin will be in the Jap War by August 15th. Finny Japs when that occurs. He writes home to his wife, Bess, the next day, the Soviets are coming in, we'll end the war a year sooner now. Think of the boys who won't be killed. He refers to the intercepted July 18th cable as, quote, the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. Truman knew the bombs weren't necessary, as did everybody around him. Yet they wanted to use the bomb, and so they went ahead and did so, in part because they wanted to send a message to the Soviet Union that if you messed with America's plans in Europe or Asia, this is what you're going to get, and even worse. And that was exactly how the Soviet leaders interpreted it. And we knew that they would. And American scientists warned American leaders that's exactly how the Soviets were going to interpret it.
Yeah. We've got, Peter, just a few minutes left. And you've spoken so well in the past and written about the lack of U.S. awareness of past crimes and death counts and, you know, nobody knowing how many were killed in Hiroshima or Vietnam or Iraq or Philippines in comparison with how Germans, for example, know the past crimes in Germany. There's a graphic going around on the internet right now in the wake of this mass killing in Orlando that says, you know, more Americans have been killed in the United States by guns since 1968 than Americans have died in all U.S. wars ever. And it gives numbers. And I think missing from that is how many non-Americans have died in U.S. wars, which, you know, just since World War II is 20, 30 million by some counts, not counting, you know, the many millions that could have been saved by putting that money to good use instead of to war. What is it going to take for, I mean, if Obama had apologized, he would have just been denounced as a traitor. He needed to tell the untold history, but, you know, to apologize in this, you know, environment, he would have just gotten himself labeled a traitor. What's it going to take for Americans to care and learn the facts?
You know, what is it going to, you and I have been working on that question for our lifetimes.
Do you think the trend's going to continue? You said for the first time ever there's a poll with a plurality on knowing the truth about Hiroshima.
But Americans know so little history that it's profoundly troubling. I did an anonymous survey with college students. These are all A students in high school. And I asked them how many Americans died in World War II, anonymous survey. The median answer I got was 90,000. I asked them how many Soviets died in World War II. The median answer I got was 100,000, which means that they not only have absolutely no understanding of World War II, they have no understanding of the Cold War, they have no idea what's going on in Ukraine. So they were only 300,000 off when it came to the number of Americans who died, but they were 27 million off when it came to the number of Soviets who died in World War II.
Yeah.
We're up against such a profound ignorance. In the National Report Card issued in 2011, American high school seniors came in last, weakest, not in their understanding of math and science, and were always bemoaning their ignorance of math and science, but they came in last in their understanding of U.S. history.
Yeah, 30 seconds left.
11% were found to be proficient in U.S. history. And so we're out there, we're trying to educate them about the past, we're trying to deal with current issues. But in order to make sense out of these current issues, you've got to put them in some kind of context. And Obama has been an impediment in that regard. When he welcomed U.S. troops home at Fort Bragg, when the troops came home from Iraq, and he spoke to them, and he says, you know what makes us great, what makes Americans different? We don't do these things for territory or for resources. We do it because it's right. That's what makes us Americans. And as long as Americans keep buying into that myth of American exceptionalism, American superiority, American difference, American benevolence, American altruism, then we're doomed. We're sunk.
Well, nobody is exposing those myths better than you, Peter Kuznick. I wish we had hours and hours to go on. We're over time, but I look forward to seeing you and encourage people to sign up for the conference at worldbeyondwar.org. And thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you too, David. Take care.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
fantasy.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in her forceful dissent from a ruling on the admissibility of illegally obtained evidence, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the decision implies that you are not a citizen of a democracy, but the subject of a carceral state, just waiting to be cataloged. The defendant in Utah versus Streiff is white, but the suspicionless stops at the case's heart disproportionately affect black and brown and poor people, marginalized in media as elsewhere. The press are now quoting Sotomayor's words, but do they really hear the message? Neeraj Sekhon is associate professor at Georgia State University College of Law. He'll join us to discuss the ruling. Also on the show, though corporate media often use the terms electorate and public interchangeably, the truth is people don't cease to be political when they don't vote. That elision erases a lot of people, from those truly opting out of the process to people excluded or discouraged from it for a variety of reasons worthy of exploration. Our guest asks what it would mean to shift focus from resisting the chipping away of voting rights to pushing for robust expansion of the franchise. Jamila Michener is assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. She'll talk with us about that. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. The suspect in the murder of British Labour MP Joe Cox had ties to a U.S. neo-Nazi organization, The Washington Post reported June 17th. Citing the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Post said the assailant was a longtime supporter of the National Alliance. Founded in 1974 by William Pierce, an associate of American Nazi Party leader George Lincoln Rockwell, the group was a reorganization of the National Youth Alliance, itself an outgrowth of Youth for Wallace, coming out of segregationist George Wallace's 1968 presidential campaign. While head of the National Alliance, Pierce published The Turner Diaries, a novel that portrays, favorably, a guerrilla race war and the mass murder of Jews, gay people, and interracial couples. A chapter depicting the bombing of an FBI building served as inspiration for the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people. Timothy McVeigh had Xeroxed highlighted pages in his car, and he called a National Alliance phone number seven times the day before. That didn't make the group a household name, though. Once it was clear that media's initial assumption that the bombing was the work of Middle Eastern terrorists was wrong, they lost interest in ideological motivation. So there was no dot to connect in 2011 when a former National Alliance member in Spokane, Washington, planted a bomb filled with shrapnel and rat poison at the Martin Luther King Day parade. It was defused, and he's serving a 32-year prison sentence. Most corporate media consumers didn't hear about that at all. Fair's Steve Rendell noted at the time it got three mentions on the nightly news in the 10 weeks that followed, compared, just for the heck of it, with 49 mentions given in that same time frame to the much less sophisticated Times Square bomb that failed to go off a year earlier, in which the perpetrator was said to have ties to the Pakistani Taliban. Longtime Counterspin listeners may remember the National Alliance as a favorite of New York talk show host Bob Grant, whose influential show aired for years on WABC, ABC Radio Network's flagship station. Grant, who regularly hosted politicians like Rudy Giuliani and George Pataki, was an open racist and homophobe, whom corporate media insisted on describing as curmudgeonly. Grant called black people subhumanoids and savages. He hosted white subway vigilante Bernard Goetz, who shot four black teenagers, and complained that Goetz hadn't, quote, finished the job by killing them all, close quote. After a gay pride parade, Grant declared, quote, ideally it would have been nice to have a few phalanxes of policemen with machine guns and mow them down, close quote. You get the idea. Curmudgeonly. Well, Grant was a big promoter of the National Alliance. He'd let callers talking about white Americans concerned about the future of their race give out contact information over the air. But even when Disney bought WABC and Grant was eventually let go, after African-American Commerce Secretary Ron Brown's plane went down over Bosnia, Grant worried on air that Brown might not be dead, media still weren't interested in the neo-Nazi group he loved so well. Which is only to say that the lack of curiosity about the influence of the violent far right is a tradition in U.S. corporate media. Don't expect the murder of Joe Cox to change that. And finally, everyone should have access to the same internet content. That, as Lisa Lynch reminded on FAIR.org, is the principle that guided last year's FCC decision to reclassify high-speed internet as a utility, subject to the same kinds of regulation as electricity, landline phone service, or other utilities that serve the public good. That was the argument for net neutrality, but it was opposed by ISPs and cable companies, who want a world in which internet content can be filtered and throttled for profit, not to put too fine a point on it. Even before the ink was dry on the FCC's Title II reclassification, the ISPs took the FCC to court, claiming the agency had overstepped its bounds. This week, the D.C. Circuit Court took the FCC's side, agreeing that broadband internet's role as the conduit to the content shaping everyday experience made reclassification a sensible choice. Over the past two decades, the judges wrote, this content has transformed nearly every aspect of our lives, from profound actions like choosing a leader, building a career, and falling in love, to more quotidian ones like hailing a cab and watching a movie. In other words, the court agreed that reclassifying the internet is a step forward, a way to recognize profound changes that have occurred in the media landscape since the emergence of the web. So, amid a number of regressive developments, we should take a moment to appreciate not just a forward-looking move, but a linchpin one, crucial to our ability to talk to one another around media gatekeepers and to work on all of the other challenges we face. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. From the media accolades for Sonia Sotomayor's dissent in a recent Supreme Court case involving the use of illegally obtained evidence, it's almost unclear if media realized that the ruling represents a loss for her point of view. With a 5-3 decision in the case Utah versus Streif, the court said that a police officer may detain someone without cause and run their identification, and if they uncover a warrant, may arrest them and charge them with additional crimes based on what they find in a search. Previously, the fact that the initial stop was illegal would mean evidence unearthed would be inadmissible. Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ginsburg dissented, with Sotomayor especially powerfully noting the disproportionate impact the ruling will have on communities of color. The dissents are worth reading in full. They raise a lot of questions about the court's understanding of how the Fourth Amendment, and indeed the law, is applied in the real world. Joining us now to help us understand the ruling and its potential effects is Neeraj Sekhon. He's associate professor at Georgia State University College of Law. He joins us now by phone from Atlanta. Welcome to Counterspin, Neeraj Sekhon.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what is the significance of Utah versus Streif for everyone, but in particular for communities of color? How would you explain it?
I think the good news is that it's not actually going to dramatically affect police practices in minority communities. The bad news is that police practices in minority communities are deplorable. Right? Minority communities bear the brunt of police abuses and excesses, as we already know. And I read Streif less as cutting new legal ground and more as just underscoring or highlighting or putting an exclamation point behind the extent to which the court is really kind of disinterested in the realities of policing in minority communities.
I've been a little bit bemused, you could say, by the tone of some coverage that suggests that Sotomayor's, in particular's, dissent was personal, as though it were qualified, but in an approved way. You know, there's a sense that she's putting a sassy Latina touch on the law, you know, rather than what you're referring to, interpreting law with regard to lived experience. I mean, isn't that really what we would hope any judge would do, is interpret the law according to how life is lived?
Well, one would hope. I think it's important to note that Justice Sotomayor takes issue not just with the result in the Strieff opinion, but with the results in a range of Fourth Amendment opinions. I mean, she's going back almost a generation and looking at Fourth Amendment law as it has evolved since the 1970s and making the point, as many have, that the Fourth Amendment hasn't been interpreted in a manner that allows for courts to respond to the realities of policing in minority communities. And so I think that Strieff was, she's reacting to it as the proverbial straw, right? I mean, it's symbolizing kind of a broader refusal to address the systemic injustices that are sort of endemic to police search and seizure practices in minority communities.
Well, and let me ask you, in arguments around stop and frisk, we often hear law enforcement say, essentially, well, we stop more black people because they commit more crimes, you know? And then the pushback sometimes amounts to, well, we just don't like that impact, you know? But there is a way to get at how police policies can be unfair, but you have to pull back from this focus that we tend to have on the individual encounter between the citizen and the police officer. I wonder, could you tell us in simple terms about the idea of departmental discretion? What does that get at?
And I can use a moment in the Strieff opinion to do that. In the majority opinion written by Justice Thomas, there's a line in which he suggests that a warrant, an outstanding warrant, is essentially a directive to police to make an arrest. And of course, that's true at some sort of abstract level, but a warrant really creates discretion to arrest. I mean, police officers ignore criminal law violations, they ignore warrants all of the time. To the extent that officers are being sent to particular neighborhoods to maximize street stops, I mean, that's an example of departmental discretion. And the officers understand their responsibility, their mandate to stop people in the street and to ask them questions and to assist them, and for whatever purpose, it might be to interdict drugs, it might be to interdict weapons. The fault doesn't in any simple way lie with individual officers in those kinds of cases. I mean, I think there's other examples of departmental discretion as well, but I think we're too often tend to focus on individual cases, individual encounters, at the expense of thinking more broadly and systematically about how police departments make policy, how they imagine enforcement priorities, and the manner in which they direct their officers to affect those policy choices. And the Fourth Amendment has evolved in such a way that the Supreme Court isn't really putting any pressure on police departments to do anything differently.
Well, not to hammer the point home too hard, but, you know, years ago when I was working in the financial district, I used to think, if you set up a checkpoint in this hallway and checked every person for cocaine, you know, you could hit your quota in 15 minutes. You know, it's a matter of where law enforcement is, you know. So when we hear the argument that, oh, we're just trying to find crime wherever it is, you're saying, well, there's choices are being made beyond the level of an individual officer that have an impact on who gets arrested.
To the extent that, let's just use the checkpoint example that you just articulated, to the extent that some hypothetical department elects to set up checkpoints exclusively in minority neighborhoods, there's no Fourth Amendment claim that can be brought to challenge any discrimination that may be inherent in that choice. The court is pretty explicitly taken racial selectivity, racial disparity off the table, the constitutional table, that is, insofar as Fourth Amendment claims go. That was in a case called Wren, the case from the 90s. And Justice Sotomayor explicitly references that case. So her upset, again, is not just about the result in Strieff, but she's very much looking at Streiff as just another moment in this long-standing judicial disinterest or hostility, really, to conceptualizing or engaging with the problems confronted by minority communities as Fourth Amendment issues.
Let me ask you, finally, media seem to have made a place, Black Lives Matter and social media and others have forced a place, if you will, for these questions that we haven't seen for some time. If you could change something about media coverage of this set of issues that you work on, or if you could see more of something or less of something else, what would that be?
Well, I think it goes back to a theme that you have mentioned a couple of times. I know that individual sensationalist individual cases are the ones that capture eyeballs, but I think the preoccupation with the sensationalist case, I think, leads the public to think that problems of, or at least some significant segment of the public, it leads them to believe that the problems of race and policing are reducible to questions of individual bias, right? The bad cop, the bad racist cop who harbors racist animosity and malevolence for minorities. And I think that we really need to start thinking about how police bureaucracies make choices, how they make enforcement choices, how they prioritize particular enforcement choices, and the kinds of practices and protocols that they use. It's a much less juicy, headline-getting approach to the question, but I think it would be more constructive and useful if more members of the media were willing to engage with these questions at that level of determination.
We've been speaking with Neeraj Sekhon of Georgia State University College of Law. Thank you very, very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you for including me. I'm happy to be a part of the conversation.
Judging by the amount of coverage alone, you'd have to assume that corporate media take elections extremely seriously. But if journalists believe so strongly in the electoral process, why are they more interested in efforts to expand participation in it? Higher voting turnouts would serve, one would think, to justify media's implied premise that elections merit attention as a legitimate, if flawed, reflection of the public interest and will. Jamila Michener is assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell, working on the politics of poverty and racial inequality in the United States. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Jamila Michener.
Thank you.
Well, your piece on American Prospects website is headlined Playing Offense on Voting Rights. It's based on the paper Race, Poverty, and the Redistribution of Voting Rights, which appears in the June issue of the Journal of Poverty and Public Policy. Listeners will know there are things for voting rights advocates to defend against. We're seeing restrictions around, for example, ID requirements that were green-lighted by the Supreme Court's weakening of the Voting Rights Act. You're not saying don't do that defense, but just that it's a mistake to stop there?
Absolutely. The defense is clearly critical in the particular political milieu that we're in. But there's a lot more to thinking about voting rights than that. Part of the reason why offense is really important is because right now participation in our democracy is really skewed. And there are specific populations that are marginal, low-income folk, folks who have disabilities, people of color who are both affected by policies in specific ways that make them more vulnerable and who participate in some cases, less in the political process. And so there's this cycle where the people whom the policies affect most acutely are not having a voice in the political process that produces those policies. And that's a problem.
It's almost like a self-tightening knot.
Yes.
Well, this has been recognized, and it's led to the creation of a couple of tools. The question your work suggests has to do, in part at least, with implementation.
Yes, so this is really important. I'm always astonished in just my regular everyday conversations with people that when I talk about legislative tools that we have for increasing participation in the political system, that there's not as widespread knowledge of these as I think there should be. And so when I mention the National Voting Rights Act to people,
first of all, they're amazed that anything like this could ever have passed. But the 1990s were a different time when Congress was doing more, for better or worse, than they're doing now. And Section 5 is the motor voter component that lots of people know about. It's the reason why when you go to the DMV, you're asked to vote. But Section 7 is a component that very few people know, that the same thing is supposed to happen when you go to public assistance agencies. You're supposed to be asked to vote when you apply for food assistance, when you apply for medical assistance, for any sort of aid from the government. And although it's supposed to happen, all of the evidence that we have suggests that it's not happening and that some states are kind of worse perpetrators, worse at complying with this law. What my research focuses on is why. Why wouldn't states comply with a law that's supposed to make our democracy better?
Well, I think as you describe who it would be reaching out to and including, listeners can start to think of reasons that people might not necessarily want to, not to be too cynical, but to include those folks. But let's talk, because it is, it might be something people would guess about, but you've actually looked at, you know, what is compliance look like and what are the different factors that seem to affect compliance with Section 7, and what did you find?
I thought precisely in the way that you just outlined, which is, well, who's going to be brought into the electorate by this law? And the answer is low-income people, people living in poverty. Because of the intersection between race and poverty, disproportionately people of color. And also because many people who have disabilities and who have other life challenges interact with government agencies, those folks. And so in particular around race and poverty, I thought, well, there are political implications to bringing low-income people and people of color into the electorate. So I paid a lot of attention to what role race played in the process. And so I found ways of measuring the extent to which states were complying with this law. And there was a lot of variation across states and even over time, mm-hmm. but the states that were doing the worst were the states that had the largest share of their population that was black. Right. So states that had many African Americans relative to other racial groups actually did a consistently worse job of complying. And also states where not just the population consisted of African Americans, but when African Americans and other folks of color did not participate in politics, so when they didn't have as much political power, when they weren't registered to vote as at high rates relative to whites in that state, that's when politicians were, it appears that there was very little accountability and very little effort on the part of political elites to comply with this law.
I've seen some scoffing at proactive registration efforts, and not just kind of a line that, oh, it's just Democrats and people who believe in big government, you know, which ties in, of course, with the Section 7 stuff, but also this idea represented by a letter to the editor in the Eagle Tribune, I think in Wichita, Kansas, that said, well, why not go all the way and have the state cast their votes for them? You know, it's this idea that voting is a privilege, and if you don't jump through whatever hoops exist for you, wherever you're situated, then you don't want it bad enough, and therefore you don't deserve it.
The thing that political scientists, people who study politics like I do, are well aware of is that the hoops aren't the same for everyone, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Lowering the barriers to voting, you might think we're making it too easy, and why should something so important be easy? But it's really an issue that it's so much harder for some folks than others. If we think about the low-income population and the number of barriers that they face in terms of having working hours that are different, that make it more difficult to find the time to register or vote, in terms of having less access to childcare, less access to transportation, even less access to discussion networks, mm-hmm. to people around you who are talking about voting, who are saying, hey, and I went and registered today, did you? They're further away from DMVs, so the motor vehicle agencies where most of us are getting registered, they're not close to those places. You know, I think if most Americans are honest with themselves, they would admit that they usually register to vote in incidental ways because they've moved and so they filled out that form at the post office, or because they went to get their driver's license so they checked that box. Most of us aren't jumping through hoops to register to vote. For most of us, it's easy. But that's not the case for low-income people, especially low-income people of color who live in urban areas or low-income whites who live in isolated rural areas. And why should those folks have less access to the franchise unless they jump through more hoops than the rest of us to be able to vote? It's really unfair.
It's hard to overstate the problem with seeing democracy as being defined by a process that, you know, hey, if some folks can't get themselves into it, that's just how it is. I remember reading years ago, lots of polling places aren't accessible by wheelchair. And, you know, hey, oops, you know, like you should have figured that out and filled out a form and mailed it in earlier. I'm talking about the way the question is presented. And I guess what I want to ask you finally is what we really want to do is expand participation in the franchise.
Yeah.
But there's also something to be said for at least naming the issue. If we aren't going to do that, we should at least acknowledge that when we talk about the democratic process and the electorate wants this and the public wants this, we should at least put a big asterisk next to that.
That's absolutely true. I mean, even when legislation passes and there's this sense that this is now the law of the land and we should accept it, but thinking about the process that produced that law and whose voice mattered, right? It really affects how we view the legitimacy of policies and of laws. And so, yeah, absolutely being straightforward about what the kind of gaps and the inequalities and the holes in the system are is really important. And it's important for changing anything. And in part, that's driven by the folks on your end, right? The journalists who are responsible for, to a certain extent, right? Not entirely, but to a large extent, responsible for shaping what the public knows about and what they don't. And it's amazing how little these issues of unequal access come up. And even when we see them in the media, it's not clear what the policy roots of these problems are. Folks focus on it as an individual problem. Well, low-income people just won't go and vote. They won't do what it takes. But not as a structural problem that's about transportation or disability access or ability to get childcare so that you can get to that polling place without having to worry about what's happening with your children. And so I think if those aspects of the barriers were emphasized more effectively, it would give people a different story than the story of, well, either you do it on your own or you're at fault.
We've been speaking with Jamila Michener of Cornell University's Department of Government. Her adapted article, Playing Offense on Voting Rights, can be found online at prospect.org. Jamila Michener, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes and Erica Bassett. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You want an ice green world full of solar panels and wind machines? So do I, but as we're about to find out, that isn't going to be easy, if it's possible at all. Of course, trying to survive in a climate wrecked by fossil fuels may not be possible either. Richard Heinberg is our guest, and he's known around the world as an energy expert. He's a leader and senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. He's the author of 13 books and a returning guest on Radio EcoShock. So when I got his newest book, written with David Fridley from the Berkeley Lab, I expected a triumphant plan for our transition to renewable energy in that post-carbon world. I was a little surprised, and we're all in for big surprises about how hard this change is going to be. It's all in the new book, Our Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy. It was published in June 2016. Richard Heinberg, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
I suppose I shouldn't be shocked. Richard, you're known for taking a hard and doubtful look at things like oil reserves and coal industry hype. Now you're digging into the realities of renewables. First of all, who is your co-author and what does he contribute to this discussion?
Well, David Fridley is a staff scientist at the Energy Analysis Program at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories. In his job, he's worked primarily with the government of China to assess and help design their national energy plan. And a lot of that has to do with renewable power. He's recently worked with the government of China and Rocky Mountain Institute, specifically on energy efficiency and renewable energy. So he's, I would say David is the number one expert in the United States on Chinese energy and one of our top experts on energy planning and specifically as that relates to renewable power.
Well, that's good news that you got him on board to work with you. Now, as you discuss in your book, this whole green dreaming world felt empowered when Professor Mark Jacobson of Stanford wrote an article in Scientific American way back in 2009. Jacobson said we can make that switch to alternative energy by 2050, and I interviewed Mark in late 2014. He felt even more certain it's all possible. What's your take on the Jacobson plan?
Well, it is. A transition to all renewable energy certainly is possible. We don't want to suggest that it isn't. However, it's not just a matter of building lots of solar panels and wind turbines, and Jacobson's plans mostly have to do with supply side. How do we supply enough renewable energy? What David Fridley and I did was look at the overall energy system, not just how we produce energy, but also how we use it. And that does present some daunting challenges, which Mark Jacobson mentions from time to time in his various proposals, but doesn't explore very deeply. Sometimes the devil is in the details, and we were looking at things like making cement. It doesn't sound like a very big thing, but cement is the main ingredient in concrete, which in turn is really the foundation of our physical civilization. Large buildings, highways, landing strips for aircraft, on and on. Without concrete, you know, it would be very difficult for us to construct and repair the world that we are used to inhabiting. Well, making cement is extremely energy intensive. It requires temperatures of about 1,500 degrees Celsius. And it would theoretically be possible to supply that kind of high heat with renewable energy, either with fuels made from renewable electricity, hydrogen, and other kinds of fuels, or directly with concentrated sunlight. It's possible to achieve those kinds of high temperatures with focused sunlight. But it's very likely that the process would be considerably more expensive, maybe 2-3 times as expensive as the current cement production process. And we have no demonstration projects. We don't even know how easy or difficult it would be or how expensive it would be because we're not even trying to do it that way. So this is a problem we ran into again and again with industrial processes and many transport modes. The substitutes, where they would be available, would likely not be drop-in substitutes. They would require research and development, and in many cases would probably be considerably more expensive than processes that we're currently using.
Well, you know, one of the questions I get all the time, Richard, is can we produce and then reproduce solar panels and wind machines without fossil fuels?
Well, that's another question. Currently, we are using fossil fuels to produce, as you say, solar panels and wind turbines. Theoretically, the process could be electrified, but we're talking about a process with many steps that starts with extraction of raw materials. Currently, the way we mine using giant mining machines that run mostly on diesel fuel, it's hard to imagine that being electrified. It's, you know, theoretically, it might be possible using electrical power produced on site and transmitted to these huge earth-moving machines via cables. Certainly, they're not going to be able to be run on batteries, but perhaps using cables, it might be possible. But again, you know, we weren't able to identify any pilot projects. And then that's just one step in the process of making wind turbines and solar panels. And you get all the way to the process of installation. With wind turbines, of course, that we go right back to the question we talked about earlier, the need for concrete. Very large amounts of concrete are used in anchoring wind turbines in place. So, you know, from the materials through high heat industrial processes all the way to delivery and installation, there are lots of challenges in producing, installing, transporting renewable energy devices using only renewable energy. And that's one of the reasons we brought up in our book the question of how are we going to use our remaining fossil fuels? Because we're going to install enough renewable energy capacity to forestall the worst of climate impacts, we're going to have to put up wind turbines and solar panels many times faster than we're currently doing it, at least 10 times faster, maybe 20 times as fast. And that will mean a lot of resource extraction, transportation, high heat industrial processes that, at least in the early to mid phases, will have to be powered by fossil fuels. So aren't we going to have to do a kind of triage where we reduce our consumption of fossil fuels for all the other things we're doing, like, you know, flying to Las Vegas for the weekend, and deliberately devote our remaining fossil fuels to the energy transition?
Yeah, you know, it calls up so many different questions from that. It's hard to know where we can go. I mean, just another example, you talked about cement. Let's talk about plastic. Everything seems to be made out of plastic now when I go to the store. Can we make plastic at all without fossil fuels?
Well, yes. There are a number of plastics now being produced using corn and other biological materials. The problem is that most of those plastics, many of which are biodegradable and could be used in a lot of packaging. The problem is that we use plastics also for purposes where we need really high performance values in medical technology, in automobiles and aircraft and so on. We need plastics that are extremely durable, heat resistant, that will withstand impacts and so on. And so far, the kinds of bioplastics that are currently available don't meet those kinds of stringent performance requirements. So one of the roadblocks we came up against was specifically in the area of pharmaceuticals. We spoke with an expert in that area who is very sympathetic to the idea of the energy transition. But he was scratching his head and saying, well, you know, look, there aren't any good substitutes right off the bat for fossil fuels as feedstocks in making pharmaceuticals. So aren't we going to have to just, you know, reduce our use of fossil fuels for energy production and save them for things like this where, you know, we just don't have any good substitutes?
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Senior Fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book, Our Renewable Energy Future. Well, we won't have time to go into everything, all the stuff you cover in the book. It's dizzying, the asphalt, the chemicals, the roads, the paint. It just goes on. But the hardest hurdle, I think, is getting fossil fuels out of agriculture. Richard Heinberg, would you care to tell our listeners some of the many places that oil, gas, and coal end up producing food for us?
Right. Well, it's not all just about diesel fuel for tractors. In fact, direct use in agriculture of fossil fuels is not the largest use of fossil fuels in our food system as a whole. It turns out that food processing is the biggest single area of energy use, and packaging is also very large. Transportation is another slice of the pie. And when you add them all together, we're using about 12 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce each calorie of food energy. So transitioning all these aspects of our food system is going to be a big job. We need to localize our food systems as much as realistically possible in order to reduce transport energy, reduce processing of food as much as possible. So we're buying foods that are less processed. Part of that processing occurs in the home, processing and storage of food in your refrigerator and on your stove. So having as efficient machines for this as possible is important, but also, you know, we have a lot of natural gas-powered stoves all across the country in people's homes, and one part of the energy transition is going to be just folks trading out their natural gas stoves for electric stoves, because we're going to have to electrify as much of our energy usage as possible in the transition. So you look at the food system as a whole, there are lots of moving parts, and we're going to have to electrify as much of it as possible. But I also want to mention the opportunity in agriculture, because up to this point, agriculture has been a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions, not only in the energy we use for all these purposes we've discussed, but also in the CO2 that's released from the soil as we degrade soil with ordinary industrial agricultural practices, tillage, application of pesticides, herbicides, and so on. We're basically killing the soil, and as the soil dies, it releases CO2 into the atmosphere. We have the opportunity to reverse that process. Lots of research has gone on in recent years in agroecology, whereby we develop and renew topsoil. We increase the biological activity of topsoil. And in doing so, we can actually capture and sequester very large amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. So by transitioning our food system, we could not only make it more amenable to renewable energy inputs and reduce energy consumption in that, also actually reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by very substantial amounts.
And, of course, this ties into the most unpopular problem of all, expanding human population. Can we sustain over 7 billion or more people without fossil fuels? And if not, are you suggesting strict social control of reproduction or a mass die-off or what?
Well, we did include a section in the book on population because we thought it was important to address the subject. It's going to be extremely difficult to supply the energy that the world currently is using from all renewable energy inputs. In fact, we think it's extremely unlikely that world energy will be able to remain at current levels or certainly to grow over future decades using only renewable energy inputs. So that raises the question of population. You know, if population is growing but energy isn't, that would mean on a per capita basis we'd have ever less energy to work with. And energy is really at the core of everything we do. So that's really a pretty stark future to imagine. But if population were declining, then all of the problems that we're talking about would suddenly become much easier to solve. If we can reduce energy per capita in a way that doesn't take away basic human requirements, that still meets basic human needs, and also reduce population, we could arrive at a situation where our energy needs are relatively easily met by renewable sources. The biggest problem that David Fridley and I identified in transitioning to the renewable future is the problem of scale. Just the vast scale of energy usage that humanity is accustomed to currently, much less what we would need if population grows and per capita usage continues to grow. That problem of scale dogs every challenge that we identified in the industrial sector and transportation and food everywhere. Scale is the biggest problem.
So, Richard, in your new book, you and David Fridley have a whole chapter on energy and justice. Why can't we just stick with solutions technology and leave all this lefty social engineering out of the plans?
Well, the reality is energy justice is already a huge issue in the world. If you look at a graph, which we reproduce in the book, of energy usage per capita and rich and poor, they align almost perfectly. If you have lots of energy available, you're able to do a lot more. So we have a world in which economic inequality is growing, and we're talking about making an enormous energy transition. How is that transition going to impact inequity? Well, it could, in fact, actually make matters worse, because it's going to cost a lot to transition to renewable energy. And if only the people with lots of money can afford to make that transition, then what we end up with at the end of the day is a few people with plenty of energy and everybody else with either dysfunctional energy systems or no energy systems to speak of. So the way we are going to get around that, I think, is with more not only distributed generation, but distributed ownership of generation. We will need cooperative and community-owned energy systems, and the only way to get there is to design from the get-go, design the process, the economic process as well as the physical process of making the energy transition, as one where ownership is in the hands of the people who use that energy.
And you have another chapter for all the issues people think you should have covered, the questions that always come up at public forums on energy transition. Let's just quickly tackle two of them. First, why don't you join James Hansen to call for more nuclear power as a way to avoid horrible climate change?
Well, the reason is we don't think that's a practical alternative. The only places in the world where nuclear power is growing are China and maybe a few other nations, India. But elsewhere, nuclear power is on the way out, and we think for good environmental and economic reasons. It's expensive and it's risky. And that's not just the judgment of environmentalists. Increasingly, it's the judgment of national governments, which have had to subsidize nuclear power for decades now. And those subsidies really haven't paid off. So we don't see nuclear power as a realistic alternative to renewables. So what we decided to do in our book is make it a thought exercise entirely around renewable energy. Yes, it's likely that in 20 or 40 years, there will still be a certain percentage of world energy coming from nuclear power. But for the purposes of our thought exercise, we excluded that.
And you do talk about changes at the consumer end, and I wonder, are people really willing to give up all their energy slaves and the freedom to fly to Las Vegas for the weekend, as you say? I mean, is that making America great again?
Well, in our view, there simply is no other way forward. We have an energy system currently that relies mostly on fossil fuels for about 85% of our energy. And that's simply an unsustainable energy system. And when I say unsustainable, I don't mean it's insufficiently eco-groovy. I mean that we can't keep doing this much longer. We're already seeing a global oil industry that's in the throes of near collapse simply because the best prospects are gone. All of our new oil production prospects are in really expensive areas like the tight oil in North Dakota and South Texas, the tar sands in Canada, deep water oil, Arctic oil, and so on. The good stuff is gone, and what's left is going to be very expensive to produce, and the economy just can't bear oil prices that high. A similar thing everywhere you look in fossil fuel industries, natural gas, coal, it's not as though we're running out of these fuels, But we are running out of the cheaply, easily accessed fuels, and that means that as time goes on, it's going to become harder, more expensive, and more environmentally risky to continue relying on these fuels. So if we do that, if we don't deliberately make a transition to renewable energy, what we will see is, you know, we will be giving up those energy perks, the trips to Las Vegas and all the rest, but we'll be doing it with no alternative.
So I'm thinking of compiling a list, maybe 25 things we can do personally to help prevent catastrophic climate change. And what would be the top five items on that list as far as you're concerned?
I think one would be doing a personal energy audit, just looking at your own life to see how you're using energy, not just in electricity, because electricity is only about 20% of all the energy that we use. So looking at energy that you use in the food that you consume, in transportation, in packaging, in the stuff you buy, and see where you can make the most difference. Many people find that cutting out air travel is the single biggest thing they can do to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, just by doing that one thing, making a personal energy audit, you can basically fill out that list of the five biggest things.
Why did you write this book, Richard?
Well, you know, more and more people are talking now about the renewable energy transition, and we think that's a very good thing. But we felt that it was really important for the discussion to get beyond just how many solar panels and how many wind turbines do we need. Energy transitions in history, you know, the discovery of fire, the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, which really should be called the fossil fuel revolution. Energy transitions are overwhelming transformations of society that usually end up transforming not just food systems and transportation, but political systems, economic systems, how people think about the world, people's daily lives. We think we're on the cusp of something just as transformative now, but the conversation is still pretty one-dimensional. We wanted to start to add some dimensionality to that conversation so that the people can begin to prepare and think realistically about what's ahead. And hopefully policymakers can do the same.
Where do people go to find out more about your new book?
Well, the best place folks can go is ourrenewablefuture.org. We have a wonderful website for the book, which has the entire contents of the book, plus a lot of material that isn't in the physical printed book. Obviously, we're happy for people to buy the physical book, but we think this information is important enough that we want folks to have access to it, whether they can afford to buy the book or not. So go to the website, and you'll find everything you want.
We've been talking to one of the best guides to a post-carbon world, author and energy analyst Richard Heinberg. His latest of 13 books is just out this June 2016. It's called A Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy. I thought I might just skim through it, to be honest, but I ended up reading it cover to cover. It's that good. Richard, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Basic life forms of the ocean are the source of most of the oxygen we breathe. Are they in deep trouble? Did you know plankton can affect the development of clouds? Another surprise in the climate story. We're talking about plankton and climate change with Dr. Michael Barenfeld. He's a senior research scientist and professor at Oregon State University. Mike specializes in marine algae research. Barenfeld is also the principal investigator for a special five-year NASA project called NAMES, with two A's, the North Atlantic Aerosols and Marine Ecosystems Study. Mike, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've kind of developed a grab bag of questions about plankton, and you're the guy, so let's take a shot at it and see how far we can get. For those new to plankton, maybe we should start with the most common misconception. People say to me, show me a plankton, like show me a tiger or something. What does plankton really mean?
Plankton, basically the word is derived from a term meaning free-floating. And there are two basic categories we think about most often in the plankton, although there's a couple more. We think about the zooplankton, which are the essentially zoo meaning animals. They're this very small animals that are free-floating in aquatic systems in the ocean and lakes. And there are phytoplankton, phyto meaning light. These are the essentially the plants of the ocean. They're microscopic. There's also bacteria, plankton, and viruses. And these make up most of the plankton.
And then we talk about a plankton bloom. What is their normal state, and then what is a bloom?
Okay, a plankton bloom is, it's basically a high concentration of phytoplankton. And along with a high concentration of phytoplankton, you also have higher concentrations of the other plankton, the zooplankton, and the bacteria, and the viruses. It's a bit of a relative term. You know, we often might be driving along a road and go by a pond in the summertime, and the pond is green. We would say that, oh, that's a phytoplankton bloom. But more of the question is about basically the process of blooming. So the process of blooming means that the concentration of phytoplankton is going from a relatively low level to a higher level. And the largest phytoplankton bloom on the planet occurs in the North Atlantic, and that's where the NAMES study is focused.
Why would NASA be interested in plankton blooms in the North Atlantic Ocean?
Wow, great question. One of the hopes, of course, is that the bloom in the North Atlantic, if we can understand that bloom, it will tell us about blooms all over the world. Hopefully the fundamental processes are similar. NASA's interested in this because phytoplankton and the zooplankton and others that eat them are the base of marine food webs. They feed our fisheries. They interact with the atmosphere. Phytoplankton take up a lot of the nutrients that get dumped into the ocean from rivers. And they also take up CO2, carbon dioxide, from the atmosphere. And NASA has actually been studying phytoplankton from space for many years, which is kind of an interesting concept to think of, that you're looking from space at things that you can't even see with your eye, these tiny little phytoplankton. But what they do is when you have more and more phytoplankton in the water, it changes the color of the water, kind of like what I said just a minute ago. You're driving down the road, you see a pond, and it's green. Well, that's because the phytoplankton are selectively absorbing different colors of light, but not very good at absorbing the green light, which is why the pond turned green. So basically, that's what the satellite is doing. It's looking at the color of the ocean. And so what NASA's interested in is being able to study the phytoplankton globally using the satellite sensors and to understand better how the phytoplankton annual cycles develop, what drives them, how they're related to the environment, the physical environment, and ultimately inform us about how the health of these planktonic ecosystems is related to the climate of the planet.
So aside from the satellites, what other tools does the NAMES project use to track these tiny life forms?
Yes, that's a good question. We're actually using a lot of different tools. The NAMES project involves ship measurements. So we have over 30 scientists going out on ships, a ship, four times over the project, studying different parts of the annual cycle. When we're on the ship, we deploy what are called autonomous floats, and these are really great devices. They go up and down in the water column autonomously, and they measure plankton properties, and they can be out there for multiple years. So after the ship leaves, we have these floats that continue the measurements for multiple years, so we can follow what happens after we have left a certain area. And studied it intensely. And then coupled with the ship measurements and the float measurements, we also have an airplane. It's a NASA C-130 Hercules, and there's a number of scientists on the airplane that are doing measurements with remote sensing instruments as well as measurements of actual direct sampling of the air. And the remote sensing measurements are an ocean color sensor, very much like what we fly in space. There's a LIDAR on the aircraft, and the LIDAR is basically a pulsing laser, and it allows us to make measurements of properties in the atmosphere as a function of the height of those properties in the atmosphere, and it also looks into the ocean and can tell us about the structure of the plankton from the surface of the ocean down to depth. And then we also have a third remote sensing instrument on there that's a polarimeter, and what it's looking at is effects of atmospheric constituents on the polarization of sunlight, essentially. I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea of polarized light when they buy polarized sunglasses.
Okay, now could you, Mike Barenfeld, please explain for us how the plankton life cycle could affect the development of clouds?
Good question. Very interesting story. So a little bit about clouds. So clouds can't form on their own, I guess you could say, without the help of aerosols. So if you just have a lot of water vapor in the air, it won't necessarily form a cloud because that water vapor has to condense around a nucleus, okay? And that nucleus is a particle, a very small particle. We're talking about particles in the size range of, about 100 nanometers or so to about a micron. And the properties of the cloud are dependent upon the abundance of these nuclei, these particles, these aerosols. And in parts of the planet, the amount of aerosols that are in the troposphere actually limits the ability of the cloud to form. And over the open ocean, certain parts of the open ocean, the abundance of those aerosols is linked to properties of the plankton. So over the course of the annual cycle, phytoplankton do their photosynthesis and they grow, they get eaten by things, and then the waste products get processed by bacteria. And through the process of wind and wave action and bubble formation, bubble bursting at the surface, these little organic molecules get released to the atmosphere and lofted up in the boundary layer, and then they can start interacting with clouds and functioning as condensation nuclei for the water vapor.
So the million-dollar question for me is, would plankton-related clouds be important enough to change the Sun-Earth energy balance? That is, can this affect climate change?
Absolutely. So like I was saying, the properties of clouds are related to the amount of aerosols that you have. If you have very few aerosols, very few of these condensation nuclei, each one of those nuclei will collect a lot of water around it. So you form clouds with large droplets, and those tend to be darker clouds. If you have a lot of aerosols, then the droplets tend to be smaller. Those tend to be brighter clouds. So brighter clouds reflect more of the sunlight energy back into space. So the brighter the cloud, the more cooling effect it has on the climate.
Now, as you know, various countries have tried stimulating plankton blooms to study carbon capture, and then a citizen named Russ George worked with the Haida Nation off Canada's west coast. They dumped over a ton of iron into the ocean, and Russ George claims a plankton bloom did result. What are your thoughts, Mike, on such experiments?
I think that the original iron enrichment experiments that were conducted were focused on the basic scientific questions of what limits the stocks of phytoplankton in the ocean. They were not focused on so much a manipulation of ocean ecosystems for carbon sequestration. In fact, I was involved in one of the first of those. It was called IronX2, which took place in the equatorial Pacific. And some of the interest in that work was, if you have populations of phytoplankton that are limited by iron, their health, their basic physiology, is different than if they're limited by something else, light or nitrogen or phosphorus. And trying to understand what parts of the ocean are limited by iron versus other factors was a very important scientific quest. And it even has a role in our way of interpreting the satellite data. There's been a lot of heated discussions about the utility of this iron fertilization for carbon sequestration, a lot of meetings about it, and there's a lot of literature out there about pros and cons on doing such a thing. I think we have to think about, we always have to think about in such manipulations of natural ecosystems beyond just the immediate goal. So, you know, what are the impacts of causing a bloom? Well, you might have more phytoplankton biomass, which might take up more CO2, but what's the fate of that? What kind of phytoplankton are going to bloom? Can we even predict that? Are they going to be a harmful species? Are they going to be a beneficial species? What are the longer-term ramifications on the food web? And what happens after the initial bloom? So there's, you know, it's a complicated story, and unless we look at all of the nuances of the consequences of such manipulations, I think that they're probably not well advised.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Michael Barenfeld, a plankton specialist with Oregon State University and a NASA project called NAMES. In the previous Radio EcoShock show, I talked with scientists Peter Brewer and John Shepherd about research into oxygen reduction in the oceans as the seas warm. Is that a real concern for plankton?
The oxygen reductions, I didn't listen to that radio show. I'm sure that Peter probably filled you in with lots of details on that. There are changes in oxygen minima zones in the ocean. They tend to be deeper than the sunlit photic zone where the phytoplankton are.
That's right. Actually, he did mention that it was further down that they're finding, you know, without enough oxygen.
Yeah. So what's happening, of course, is that you have photosynthesis going on in the surface by the phytoplankton, and then some of that organic carbon that they form is not recycled in the surface and is exported or sinks down to deeper depths, and then it gets utilized by other organisms that use up the oxygen while they're using up the carbon. And so that's why you get this separation between the photosynthesis at the surface and these deeper oxygen minima zones.
And, you know, I've read stories that global plankton are in decline, some say up to 40% loss. Where are we with that? Is global plankton in decline?
The best record that we have about the global state of the phytoplankton is satellite data. Satellites give us that true global view. It's really hard to make a global assessment with ships or just measurements from a dock or something like that. What we see in the satellite record so far, which started in 1978, and there was a gap until 97, and then from 97 to the present, we've had continuous measurements. What we see is that the variations, if you look at the globe as a whole, that variations in the phytoplankton currently are dominated by what appears to be natural variations in climate. So El Nino, La Nina transitions tend to have a very large global footprint. And we can see that and relate it to those kinds of climate fluctuations, oscillations in the Pacific and the Atlantic, et cetera. Teasing out an anthropogenic component of that is very complex. So I don't think that there is, from a globally integrated perspective, a definitive study showing or distinguishing the natural variability from the anthropogenic variability. Now, that being said, when you start looking at regional variations, the regional variations tend to be much stronger. And so that we do see trends not only in the abundance of phytoplankton, but also the organisms that are dominating during different times of the year. So when you start looking more regionally, the interannual changes tend to be larger, and they not only include changes in the total, they also include changes in the players.
And what about ocean temperature? I mean, some parts of the ocean, say around Australia or closer to your study area in New England, have been abnormally hot in recent years. What effect does that have on plankton?
It's a complex question, actually. The answer to it is complex, I'm sorry. So temperature has both direct and indirect effects on plankton. There are direct metabolic effects on plankton, but there are also indirect effects. And what I mean by that is that if you warm the surface of the ocean, that influences the ability of nutrients deeper depths to get into the surface area where the phytoplankton are growing. It also influences how much light the surface phytoplankton see. And so the indirect effects on the nutrient supply and the light supply that the phytoplankton experience is probably, or is almost certainly, the greater consequence of the temperature changes. And so we see this very clearly in the satellite data, that we can look at the relationship between phytoplankton abundance and sea surface temperature. And when we look at the changes in those two properties, we see that we generally have a reduction in the photosynthetic pigments that the phytoplankton have when temperatures warm, and when temperatures cool, those pigments go up. And that pigment response is a reflection of nutrient availability and how much light the cells are seeing. So to be a little more specific, when a phytoplankton, holding all other things constant, when a phytoplankton sees more nutrients, it gets greener because it's growing faster. It needs to collect more light, just like a plant in your house would. If they see more light for a given amount of nutrients, they get less green, okay, because they need less pigment to absorb the energy that they need from the sun if there's more sunlight. Okay, so you have a trade-off between these two things. So what we see from the satellite clearly is that when there's warming of the surface ocean, the pigment goes down, and that pigment signal is both an effect of nutrients and effect of light.
I think another NASA press release suggested that plankton will thrive closer to the poles as the globe warms and perhaps dwindle around the tropics. Would you agree with that?
Again, that comes back to the basic question of the, you know, the limitations of light and nutrients. And so I think that probably what was being suggested there is that toward the tropics, the phytoplankton tend to be persistently limited by nutrients. And if you warm the surface, it just makes it harder and harder for nutrients to get to the surface. In the higher latitudes, for large portions of the year, nutrients are pretty high in their concentrations, and light is the limiting thing. So if you're warming those waters, it's possible that the phytoplankton near the surface are actually experiencing more light, so they would have a faster division rate. Now, one of the other things that we always should keep in mind when thinking about these blooms or these abundances of phytoplankton is that the abundance of phytoplankton is not just dependent upon how fast the phytoplankton are growing. It's also dependent upon how fast they're being eaten. So it truly is an ecology problem. And the way I like to explain this to people sometimes is if you look at your lawn, you can't tell how fast the lawn is growing by how tall your grass is, right? Because it depends on how fast it's growing and how often you're mowing it. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay, so the same thing with the phytoplankton. When you're looking at the stalks of the phytoplankton, it's the net effect that you're looking at between how fast the phytoplankton are growing and how quickly they're being eaten. And so it always is an ecological problem, not just a problem of light and nutrients.
It is really mind-blowing, Mike, to look at photos from space satellites at those blooms. They look like artwork and almost the size of European countries. How big do they get and how fast can they develop?
Wow, great question as well. So how big can they get? The North Atlantic bloom, as I mentioned before, is the largest bloom over spatially anywhere on the planet. And it starts from about New England, 45 degrees latitude-ish, you know, New England, England, and goes up to the pole. And the bloom reaches its peak in early May to June, July, and it goes, the peak is earlier to the south, and it's delayed as you go further to the north, of course, following light and temperature changes. Is that what you wanted to know?
Yes. I also wanted to know sort of how fast that can happen. I mean, are we talking weeks or months or?
Yeah. So this is actually a very interesting question. And it's one of the driving science questions for the NAMES project. So the traditional view of the North Atlantic bloom was that the bloom started in the spring, and it was kind of like the greening of trees on land, right? So if you live in a deciduous forest, we know that every spring, you know, in the wintertime, the landscape is brown, and in the spring, all of a sudden, the trees start throwing these leaves. Why is that? Well, the reason for that is that the trees are monitoring the temperature and light conditions, and when they get the right cues, it says, okay, it's time for us to start throwing leaves. So in other words, it's driven by light and temperature. And then you get the full leaving in the summer. And traditionally, we've thought that, well, that's probably what's going on in the ocean, that you have some critical light and temperature condition, and that's when the bloom starts. Well, interestingly, once we started having satellites that could look at this ocean all the time, in other words, all year long, normally we send our ships out when the conditions are better. But with a satellite, it doesn't get seasick, so, you know, it can actually watch what happens in the winter. And what we've recently discovered is that, in fact, the blooming period in the North Atlantic starts in the winter. And it comes to an end when the division rate, the growth conditions, are at their peak. Okay? And that's kind of strange. It's like saying that trees start throwing their leaves in winter, and they drop their leaves when they get to the best time in early summer. And so one of the questions we have is, well, what could possibly drive that? Why would we see that in the North Atlantic? And why is it so different than on a terrestrial system? So getting back to your question, what that means is that the blooming phase of the plankton annual cycle in the North Atlantic starts in December-ish, and it lasts until June. So it lasts for many, many months. So that's kind of the speed of this. Now, over the course of that period, you have periods where they start declining again, and then they come up again. So it's not just this constant blooming. It's going up and down and up and down, and that's tied to the physical environment, light and storms and things like that. So you can have short-term bursts, which only last for a few days, for a few weeks, but the whole blooming event takes place over the course of many, many months.
And I've heard hints from scientists that warming could favor bacteria that actually eat plankton or destroy plankton. Can this balance be kept, or is it possible that something terrible could happen to the plankton?
Well, that's a big question. So as I mentioned when we first started talking, you know, one of our hopes with this project is to better understand this control, this annual cycle of the plankton bloom. And understanding that is not just about how fast they're growing, as I mentioned before, because there's also the things that kill them. You have zooplankton, viruses, and bacteria. And so understanding how that link, this basically it's a question of predator-prey relationships. How is that intimate food web of the plankton tied to the environmental conditions? Why do we get a bloom every year in the North Atlantic? And why is it different some years? Why is it lower one year and higher in another? Trying to understand that is really a core of this project. And that comes down to fundamental questions of losses of the phytoplankton to the bacteria you're talking about, but also to the grazers and to the viruses.
As a last sort of question, I'm going to open it up to you to say anything you like in just a minute. But before that, supposing in a coming decade, the international community recognizes that plankton are in serious trouble. Is there anything we could do about it, or is this a massive system well beyond any human intervention?
It is definitely a massive system. So can we do anything about it? If we find that, you know, that there's a clear signature or a clear effect of climate warming on the plankton of the globe, what would be necessary is to try and slow that climate trend down in order to hopefully reverse or stop whatever trend it is that we're trying to stop, which would take a very enormous cooperative effort to do. Is there a simple fix to the problem? No, I don't think there is a simple fix to the problem. We can't just go out and seed it with something. So it's a very complex system, and if trends start happening, we have to understand, first of all, why they're happening. And I'm not sure how well we could react in a manner that would stop some trend in global plankton communities.
Right. That's kind of what I suspected. As we wrap up here, Mike Barenfeld, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
Yeah, so there's one thing I thought I would mention. This is kind of an interesting anecdote. So a while back, if you had asked me, you know, what is the influence of phytoplankton on clouds, I would have been skeptical if there was one. And then I started learning about the research that was being done about this influence of ocean biology on atmospheric aerosols. And these are aerosols that are in what we call the lower boundary layer of the troposphere. That's from the surface of the ocean up to about where the base of clouds are. Okay, this is a well-mixed area. And as it turns out, there are certain parts of the global oceans where the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere is low enough that it can actually limit cloud formation. And so you might ask me, well, where are those places and why are those places? Those places are found particularly at higher latitudes and in truly open ocean areas. And what I mean by that is places in the ocean that are far away from land. So land gives off a lot of aerosols, and some of those aerosols are carried out over the ocean. But in this boundary layer, which is so important for cloud formation, this boundary layer, the lifetime of those aerosols from land is very short. It's on the order of a couple of days. And so as you get away from land, and particularly where there's common storms, rainstorms, because rain removes this from the atmosphere can become extremely clean. In other words, there's very, very low aerosols. And one of the interesting things that we did on the first NAMES cruise, which was in November of this last year, is we took a cup of coffee outside. Okay, so this is November, south of Greenland. It's cold, right? We take a cup of hot coffee out there, and guess what comes off the top of the coffee mug?
Steam?
That's what you'd expect, but there was no steam. Why is that? It's really interesting, right? You actually can go out in this freezing cold air, and you're not getting steam off of your cup. There's water vapor coming out of your cup of coffee, but there's no steam because there's so few aerosols, the steam can't form. Steam is the formation of water droplets. It's water condensing around particles. And if you take that cup of coffee and then you put a cigarette lighter up next to it and you flick the cigarette lighter provides a few aerosols, and you get a puff of steam. And it was kind of one of those moments for me scientifically where I was like, oh, I get it, right? Yes, I can see how this part of the ocean can actually be significantly influenced by the biology. There's so few aerosols up there that, you know, even though the load of aerosols coming from the ocean plankton may be small, it's a big source for that part. And yeah, you can see that, oh, this is important. This could really make a difference. And if we see changes in the plankton over time, for whatever reason, that source of aerosols to that atmosphere is going to change. And that is going to change the clouds. And that, of course, then feeds back on the climate. As we talked about, you know, the more aerosols you have, the brighter the clouds, the more they reflect, the more they cool. So it was just kind of one of those really cool, tangible examples of like, oh, yeah, I really get it. This is important.
I love that story. From Oregon State University, we've been talking with Dr. Michael Barenfeld. He is the lead scientist in a project by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to study plankton blooms in the North Atlantic. That's the North Atlantic Aerosols and Marine Ecosystem Study with the acronym NAMES. Find it at names.larc.nasa.gov. Or if you missed that, get links for everything in this interview in my show blog at ecoshog.info. Mike, thank you so much for your work and for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That seems like a good place to leave it for now. Somewhere out in the ocean, there is still air so pure, human-driven dust cannot be found. According to Michael Barenfeld, who is an acknowledged expert on satellite records of plankton, there is no evidence these essential ocean creatures are being killed off by climate change. That does run against headlines published in the Independent newspaper on July 28, 2010, titled, "The Dead Sea, Global Warming Blamed for 40% Decline in the Ocean's Phytoplankton." That frightening article was based on a study published July 2010 in the journal Nature by Daniel G. Boyce et al. It's called Global Phytoplankton Decline Over the Past Century. However, there has been a reevaluation in reading satellite data on plankton. Based on the point made by Mike Barenfeld in this interview, scientists have found that when conditions warrant, phytoplankton have less color and may be harder to see. In September 2015, NASA released a study showing diatoms, the largest phytoplankton algae, have declined by more than 1% globally every year from 1998 to 2012. Most of this decline was in the Northern Hemisphere, especially in the Northern Pacific Ocean. But Dr. Barenfeld did tell us that regional declines have been found, even though there is no published evidence yet supporting a global decline of all plankton. The balance of types of plankton may also be changing. It's complicated. Remember, in my show posted January 20th, 2016, Russian-trained plankton modeler Sergei Petrovsky said we don't yet know whether plankton will thrive or die off as the oceans warm. That's still a topic of scientific study and debate. But Petrovsky also said his models show that in either case, thrive or decline, plankton reaches a crisis point in warming where a massive die-off can occur. I'll put a link to that show in my blog at ecoshock.info. But for now, I'm going with this picture of an ocean which is struggling but far from dead. That's an important part of Radio EcoShock. We have plenty to worry about. There's no doubt about our future prospects that are cloudy, if not dire. I've had dozens of scientists on the show already this year who explain why. That said, there is a tendency in the public to expect, almost hope for, the worst, and soon. Some of us are tired of the strain. We want to see the end times before our lives end. It's been that way for thousands of years, at least for Christians, who may die disappointed they didn't see the terrible battles and Christ returning. Other thoughtful people realize our civilization is a heat engine, as the Utah scientist Tim Garrett told Radio EcoShock listeners a few years ago. We eat up ancient forests, don't we, for throwaway products? We dig up radioactive rocks and make them even more concentrated and poisonous. We burn fossil fuels for entertainment. We hunt and kill rare animals and plants for fun. We can't go on as we are and still leave a working ecosystem for our descendants, that's plain. There are serious scientists who will tell you, off and off the air, that only a severe economic crash can avert a mass extinction event. All the financial signs are flashing that collapse is coming. But then, the machine so far has kept running somehow. Most of us want it to keep going. After 45 straight shows peering into the dark future, I'm more than ready for my annual vacation. It's summer in the Northern Hemisphere. It will be a working vacation for me, as I harvest our large garden and put away lots of good food for the coming winter. That's how I stay sane, if I do, and that's part of the reason I can afford to donate my time for the science and activism that is Radio EcoShock. I still need your support to help pay for free downloads of the show around the world, plus the website and other ongoing costs that keep going month after month. I'm so grateful to those who have kept me going so far. Listeners have made this program possible. Please consider either a one-time donation of any amount or becoming part of the team of subscribers who give $10 a month for Radio EcoShock. Find out how at ecoshock.org. For the next few weeks, I'll be broadcasting shows from the large archive of past interviews. I'll be picking from programs that were downloaded thousands of times by listeners, some of them tens of thousands of times. There are voices which are either reflecting our minds or challenge them deeply. Our Radio EcoShock podcast is back, by the way. You can find the show on iTunes or any other podcatcher. Find the clickable podcast icons in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Feel free to browse all our past programs, to load up your iPod, computer, or MP3 player for summer listening with our free shows, or winter in the Southern Hemisphere. People in 91 countries listen to Radio EcoShock by podcast, on our SoundCloud page, or directly from the website at ecoshock.org. Of course, the podcast and blog only come out after the broadcast by our 94 participating nonprofit radio stations. That's the backbone of the show, and by far our largest audience. It's in the United States, Canada, the UK, and Australia so far. I deeply appreciate the volunteers and staff who make this radio station work, mostly advertising-free, well out of the corporate lens. Frankly, at this point, only non-corporate media seems willing to risk talking about the whole truth of climate change, our energy predicament, and the peril to all creatures. Which leads me back to two last things for now. As I said, despite the real scientific warnings, we have to be wary of apocalyptic messages that are not based on evidence. Second, as Richard Heinberg reminds us, there may be a way to safety with renewable energy, but it's not going to be easy. The changes each of us need to make are fundamental and difficult. We have to do a little better with nature every day and a lot better every year. Meanwhile, I'll be watching the world news and checking new science. I may toss a new tune on SoundCloud or blast out a short YouTube video. You'll get notice of that from my Twitter feed. Sign up at EcoShock. If anything extreme blows up or something just can't wait, I may have to do a new show or two. I hope not. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to learn, along with you, from some of the best minds of our generation. I'll be back with more original interviews at the start of September. Until then, please stay tuned as the best of Radio EcoShock comes your way every week. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
It's the Taylor Report, CIT at 9.5 FM, and I think we are joined by Ann Garrison. Are you there, Ann?
Yes, I am.
I should say anngarrison.com, and people know her from KPFA Weekend News and Counterpunch and all sorts of places, but you can start with anngarrison.com. And we've spoken to you in the past about a number of issues. So on one occasion, I think we did talk about a situation in to do with the ecology or the issues of the green movement, but largely now we want to talk about the candidate of the Green Party, Jill Stein, and why you've taken up the cause of Jill Stein.
Well, I've been a member of the Green Party for many years now, and I supported Jill Stein and voted for her in 2012. I will again this year. But Bernie Sanders, we have to give credit, as Jill has, to Bernie Sanders for stirring up a movement that is now divided between those who will go ahead and vote for Hillary Clinton and the group called Bernie or Bust. This is an informal movement within the Bernie supporters that is not going to support Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. So what choices do they have? Gary Johnson, the libertarian, who doesn't really reflect most of their values, but does reflect some. And the Libertarian Party is very much against U.S. intervention, U.S. military intervention abroad. Mm-hmm. But their domestic policies really don't reflect the Bernie or Bust movement.
Yeah.
Jill Stein does. And everything that Bernie has said, Jill Stein says that much more.
I'd agree. I was listening to her interview on Democracy Now!, and I also read – I love this. You can go on Twitter and find out what Jill Stein is thinking, and I do that. And her language is clearer and stronger than that of Bernie Sanders. And one of the things noticeable about Sanders' campaign was that when he hit those notes about being less of a militarized state of – for stopping interventionist policy. He didn't hit it heavy, but when he did, the crowd always responded.
Absolutely. And I was watching one of Bernie's rallies in the Northwest, and everyone was responding to everything that he said. They were chanting, Bernie, Bernie. And then he started talking about arming Saudi Arabia further so that they could go ahead and win their war there. And the crowd went stone cold silent. And I noticed, you know, I followed Bernie's speeches. I went to one here in Vallejo, and that's a city within the Bay Area in East Bay. And usually he had the same stump speech. He hit all the same points. But I did not hear him repeat that stuff about arming Saudi Arabia in any later speeches.
Yeah. In other words, they were editing Bernie for Bernie.
Well, that was my impression.
They were educating Bernie.
I wasn't on the inside, but it looked to me like they were noticing what the crowd was responding to and not responding to.
Yeah.
And Jill Stein wants to cut the military budget by half immediately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Withdraw troops from the Middle East and withdraw troops from the African continent.
Now that, yes, now you and I follow Africa closely. We're one of the things Americans have not been permitted to know is that this AFRICOM operation has really, particularly after Libya, doubled down, and the U.S. forces are all over Africa. So if she's calling to remove them, that would be a major blessing for the people of Africa.
And I have to say, you know, it's never one person. It's never the candidate only. It's also who's around the candidate, who has the candidate's ear, who does the candidate trust to inform them. And Bruce Dixon's involvement with the Jill Stein campaign and the Green Party ballot access drive in Georgia has had a lot to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce has wanted the Green Party platform, which will be hammered out in Houston at the Green Party convention in August, to include this plank about withdrawing all U.S. troops from the African continent.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Ann Garrison. I'll just say anngarrison.com.
Thank
so you.
That's
can
cute.
Follow.
Well, I like that.
Yeah, you can follow Ann. She has a third name, .com.
My last piece that's on the .com site was anngarrison.com, was about registration and re-registration drives in the state of California, because in the state of California, the Green Party lost about 30% of its voters to those who re-registered to be able to vote for Bernie in the Democratic primary.
So are you saying that's like a sacrifice? Am I following that?
Well,
they had to cross over.
They had to cross over. The Democratic primary in California is semi-open, meaning it is open to those who are registered Democrat and those who are registered no party preference. But you've probably heard this was a big controversy in California about the no party preference voters.
Mm-hmm.
They're entitled to vote in the Democratic primary, but in most cases, they have to go up to the poll workers and say, I'm registered no party preference, but I want a Democratic crossover ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them were given provisional ballots.
Yeah.
And so we now have 2.5 million ballots that still haven't been counted in the state of California. Some of them are these provisional ballots, which a lot of people claim were thrown away. I don't know that that's true, but Greg Palast, for instance, the writer on election scandals in the U.S. for the last decade mm-hmm. and a half, claims that provisional ballots are all thrown away. I don't think it's quite that bad, but people who cast provisional ballots typically walk away wondering whether their vote's really going to be counted. And now we have 2.5 million ballots. Some of them are absentee ballots. Others are provisional.
I'd call that a 2016 scandal. You could have that many uncounted ballots, and meanwhile Hillary's dancing the victory dance. And,
exactly.
There ought to be a referee who tells her to go to a neutral corner while we count.
Well,
Muhammad Ali analogy. You know what? Something very striking in Jill Stein's statements that I like very much, and she's tackling this issue of fear, how the politics of fear. She says you're only free if you can vote for what you want. But given the way with the two-party system, you only vote for what you're afraid of, or you vote because of what you're afraid of.
Yes, and that's the slogan of the Georgia Green Party that Bruce Dixon is involved with as well. Vote your hopes, not your fears.
Yeah.
We've been told, a lot of voters are least worst voters, and every 4 years they're told we have to vote for the Democrat to avoid the Republican, but that argument and the duopoly are breaking down. I mean, the Republican Party is in disarray, so is the Democratic Party. there are a lot of those in the Bernie for Bust camp who are likely to get up and walk out of the convention if and when Bernie Sanders endorses Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. It's so vital to and I notice there's some good writing on this now various people, but pointing out that the great changes in American life have come about because of third parties. That the Republicans, created by Abraham Lincoln, among others, but it was a new party, a third party, that brought about the end of slavery.
Exactly.
And that it was not going to end so long as you had Democrats and Whigs. It was just going to go on and on and on.
And Ralph Nader has written quite a bit about this. If you just Googled Ralph Nader and third party.
Yes, Ralph Nader was the name I was looking for, exactly.
So has Jill Stein. And in fact, on Saturday for KPFA, I was speaking to Laura Wells, who has run for statewide office. She's very popular here. And she's one of the people who secured our ballot access. Because when you talk about third parties, and Greens or Libertarians or anybody else, you have to consider the ballot access barriers. And Bernie avoided the ballot access barriers by running as a Democrat. That meant he could get his name on the ballot in all 50 states, territories, and D.C.
Yes.
But Greens, Libertarians, any other third party, they have to overcome the ballot access issues. And Laura Wells, because when she ran for controller in the 2012 election, she got a significant percentage of the vote, even though she was running as a Green, that solved that, and also our treasurer candidate, Ellen Brown, of the Public Banking Institute, she got something like 14% of the vote. I might be wrong about those stats, but that's what I'm remembering. I need to look them up. But anyway, they're getting that large a percentage is one of the things that guarantees that the Green Party will remain on the ballot. You will see its name on the ballot. If a party's name is not on the ballot, writing that candidate in will not do any good. It'll just be tossed unless the candidate has jumped through a lot of hoops to become an official write-in candidate.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the write-in ballot is not counted. And so all these people who say they're going to protest by writing in Bernie are going to throw away their vote unless Bernie has somehow qualified to be on the ballot, which he doesn't seem inclined to do.
Well, Anne, that's a great place to end. Thank you for talking about Jill Stein. I'm going to follow her every day of the week. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
Taylor Report, CIUT, Indigenous Waves is next. We'll see you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Stacy Hopkins, co-founder of the group Brand New Congress, who discusses the goals of this new political organization, which grew out of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Rachel Curley of Public Citizens Congress Watch, who describes the campaign to win passage of the proposed We the People Democracy Reform legislation, targeting big money in U.S. politics. And Art Tanderup, a farmer and activist with Bold Nebraska, who talks about his group's expansion of its mission to support local anti-pipeline campaigns across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A day before Brazil's Senate voted to go forward with impeachment proceedings and the suspension of Workers' Party President Dilma Rousseff, key right-wing opposition leader Jair Bolsonaro was in the Middle East being baptized in the Jordan River. The trip to Israel was organized by evangelical pastor Reverend Everaldo Pereira, leader of Brazil's Social Christian Party, to baptize Bolsonaro and his sons. During the 10-day trip to the Holy Land, Bolsonaro, a retired army officer and proponent of gun rights, lauded Israel's right-wing government and praised the might of the Israeli military. Bolsonaro and his allies in Brazil's so-called Bullet Caucus campaigned hard to remove Rousseff and her ruling Workers' Party from power. Since entering Brazil's lower house of Congress in 1990, Bolsonaro has been an advocate for gun rights, increasing the military budget, and privatizing prisons. A decade ago, the caucus worked with the U.S.-based National Rifle Association to kill a proposed law banning civilian gun purchases. In Brazil's most recent national election, the tough-on-crime rhetoric of the Bullet Caucus boosted its popularity, enabling their members to win control of a majority of seats in the lower house. But with their success in ousting President Rousseff, the pro-gun caucus, in coalition with the Christian right, is now intent on frustrating Brazil's ongoing efforts to turn the page on military dictatorship, pushing measures that may bring lethal consequences in a country that already racks up the highest absolute number of murders. By a 3-to-1 margin, voters in Switzerland rejected a recent ballot initiative that would have established a universal income, allocating a monthly grant of 2,500 Swiss francs to each adult citizen, or about $2,560 U.S., and 625 francs for each child under 18, regardless of employment status. Supporters launched the initiative to fight poverty and social inequality and guarantee a dignified life to everyone. Although the ballot measure failed, the campaign triggered a national debate over the growing numbers of jobs being lost to automation and globalization. Backers of the universal income plan didn't declare how much their system would cost, but opponents warned that the price tag could cost 25 billion Swiss francs annually and require deep spending cuts. In colorful protests leading up to the vote, hundreds of activists acting as robots moved through Zurich, promising to free workers from the daily grind of needing to earn a paycheck. Across Europe and elsewhere, new pilot projects are emerging that employ the concept of a guaranteed income. In Finland, the government is considering a trial to give basic income to about 8,000 people from low-income groups. The Dutch city of Utrecht is also developing a pilot project for basic income. Around the world, many governments from Australia to Canada are taking a closer look at the administrative costs of running complex welfare systems and asking themselves whether a basic income would simply be cheaper. Philadelphia citizens have filed a class action lawsuit against the city water department for lax water testing procedures that could conceal lead contamination, an echo of the tragic water crisis revealed in Flint, Michigan. The lawsuit comes as the Guardian newspaper reports 33 cities in the eastern United States, including Philadelphia, use water testing practices that can underestimate dangerous levels of lead in drinking water. Experts said three seemingly harmless instructions provided to residents in Philadelphia could have a profound impact on how much lead is found in water. These methods include removing the filter at the top of the faucet, running the tap before a 6-hour test period, and slowly pouring water sample bottles. The EPA warned a decade ago that cities should stop using these techniques. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, a pediatrician credited with bringing Flint's crisis with lead-tainted drinking water to the public's attention, recently wrote, "Regrettably, our research reveals that the potentially increasing threat of lead in drinking water may dampen the significant strides in childhood lead prevention efforts. As our aging water infrastructures continue to decay, and as communities across the nation struggle with finances and water supply sources, the situation in Flint, Michigan, may be a harbinger for future safe drinking water challenges." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After emerging victorious in a string of primary elections on June 7th, Hillary Clinton won the pledged delegates needed to become the nation's first woman to capture a major party presidential nomination. Over the last week, Clinton has turned her attention to forcefully challenge the positions and caustic rhetoric of the Republicans' presumptive candidate, Donald Trump. But while her Democratic Party opponent, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, hadn't yet suspended his campaign, preferring to continue the fight until voters had cast ballots in the nation's last primary in Washington, D.C., on June 14th, it was clear that his quest for the nomination was over. Sanders, who called for a political revolution, surprised many political observers by winning 22 state primaries and caucuses, drawing 1.5 million people to his rallies, and raising $228 million from about 2.5 million small donors. The candidate reportedly will now pursue changes in the Democratic Party platform that will include planks advocating a $15 an hour minimum wage, universal health care, and tuition-free public colleges and universities. But while thousands of Sanders supporters are expected to attend a national conference in Chicago June 17th through 19th, dubbed the People's Summit, to debate the future of the revolution, a group of former Sanders staffers have already formed a new political organization called Brand New Congress. This new nonpartisan group aims to harness the skills and fundraising power of the Sanders campaign to win congressional seats with the goal of moving the country in a more progressive direction. Your reporter spoke with Stacey Hopkins, co-founder and team leader with Brand New Congress, who discusses the short and long-term objectives of this new Sanders-inspired political organization.
We decided to come together, a couple of former staffers and volunteers who worked with the campaign and also the grassroots. We recognized that some of the missteps made was not recognizing the energy and organizing power and talent that was in the grassroots, and we said we didn't want to watch the energy that was created go dormant or get distilled or, you know, fall into apathy. So we said, you know, what instead of asking the question, what's next, what if we just say, look, we have an idea? So we launched a brand new Congress, and the idea is it's very simple. One plan, one unified campaign, and the goal is to have 535 members of Congress all supporting the Bernie platform. We realize that is a large goal, but it is a goal, you know, and it's definitely possible. We definitely can change the face of Congress. We feel that it is not representative of the people in terms of racial or gender parity. We have a Congress that is out of touch, that really can't agree on anything. I like to say they can't agree on lunch. And they have brought us nothing but standoffs and shutdowns and obstructionism. And they haven't done the really necessary work of the people. We have crumbling infrastructure. We have temporary stopgap measures that have damaging cuts to people who've done no harm. And while we have seen our coffers raped and pillaged to pay for, you know, endless wars. And so we think that the people, the actual people who Congress is supposedly created by, should reflect that. So that is one of our goals and objectives, to do that. And we're on tour, and we are coming to communities across America to look for those honest, accountable people that we need. And we all know them. Some of them may actually be us. So we are doing events, something like the Bernie Barnstorms, and starting the conversation and starting the organization that's really going to be part of the infrastructure that is going to take this campaign to not just 2018, but beyond.
Stacey, tell us a bit about how this new group is structured and how it's different than other political action committees or other organizations that try to get people elected to Congress. From my understanding, you're going to be doing fundraising at a national level to help your chosen candidates district by district, which takes a lot of the burden off of the individual candidates, where money is has long been a major obstacle to getting grassroots folks elected to Congress who aren't beholden to special interests.
Absolutely. So our campaign is a mechanism that frees our candidates up from the hamster wheel and what is known as business as usual in politics by being the supportive financial mechanism for them. We're providing the services that they would have to seek. You know, we would be giving voter files. This is a way of freeing candidates up to do what they do best, meeting with the voters and getting their message out. We will provide like in-house shop for them. The beauty is we all have the platform for Bernie, and that is the agreement that the candidates run on. So we support them. We free them up to be better candidates, which in turn gives us better government, which gives us better and progressive policies that a lot of people, regardless on which side of the aisle, agree on.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stacey, I wanted to ask you this. In your estimation and testing the waters with this new organization in recent months, do you believe that the organizers and Bernie Sanders supporters from the campaign can make the transition to a longer-term commitment without all the energy, media coverage, and short-term goals that state-by-state primary elections bring? It's certainly a much larger commitment in the long run to move Congress in a way different direction than it is to win a, you know, a statewide primary campaign.
It's going to be challenging. Any movement has that challenge. And, you know, with Bernie, he was ignored for a long time, and it wasn't, you know, mainstream media that made him or created those crowds. It was social media. It was independent media. we can't expect to create change by doing things old ways. We can't depend on unreliable systems that weren't created in our favor to suddenly start acting that way.
That was Stacy Hopkins, co-founder and team leader with a new political organization, Brand New Congress. Learn more about Brand New Congress by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last April, a coalition of more than 260 advocacy groups supported a series of protest and civil disobedience actions in Washington, D.C., called Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening. Their activists demanded the overturning of the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United ruling that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. political campaigns, reforms to end the corrupting influence of big money in politics, and free and fair elections that give every American an equal voice. The enthusiastic public support for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign message, denouncing the unchecked influence of a small group of billionaires on U.S. politics, reflects public opinion polls where large numbers of Americans express the belief that our democracy is broken. As the 2016 presidential and congressional election campaign swings into high gear, political spending is predicted to break the previous record of $6.3 billion spent in 2012. On June 9th, Democrats in the U.S. Senate, seeking to address growing public concern, announced a new package of proposed legislation that they say is designed to hold the government more accountable, amend the Constitution to end unlimited campaign contributions, and reform the lobbying laws to limit special interest influence on elected officials. Your reporter spoke with Rachel Curley, Democracy Associate with Public Citizens Congress Watch, who summarizes the set of bills being proposed in the Senate, known as the We the People Democracy Reforms.
I think the impetus for the action in the Senate really came from the awareness in our country at how fed up people are at the presence of special interests in our democracy. Polling shows us that 85% of Americans think that the way we fund campaigns needs to be changed. That's a really high number. Tons of people understand that corporations have more say than we do in our elections, and they are tired of that. They are tired of seeing that happen time and time again. And so I think the Democrats in the Senate see that people are deeply moved by this issue, and they want to see change. And so they are taking a stand and putting forth legislation that could make these changes. There are a lot of things in this package, but I will try and summarize them. One section of it covers transparency and disclosure, so making the donations that come to candidates and their campaigns clear and transparent so we know where they're coming from. So some of that is mandatory disclosure of campaign donations. Some of it is requiring candidates for federal office to report major contributions within 48 hours. So right now, reporting is not really happening in real time. And if it happened in more real time, that would increase transparency around who is funding our elections. And then another piece of it is reining in these super PACs that are also collecting huge amounts of money for campaigns. So that's one piece of it. Like I said, disclosure and transparency. Another is affecting laws around lobbying. So most folks know what lobbyists are. You know, they go to Congress and talk about specific issues that affect their clients. And there are rules around lobbying right now. You do have to be registered, but the Senate Democrats want to go further. One of the things that they want to do is enact a ban on former members of Congress becoming lobbyists. So once you've left Congress, either in the House or the Senate, you're no longer allowed to come back and lobby for something. The one other thing I'll mention is that this does include a constitutional amendment that would overturn the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United, which was the case that opened the floodgates for corporate spending in elections.
Is there a realistic possibility that Congress could pass some of this legislation, or is this going to be used in a way to keep politicians accountable when they are up for re-election this November?
The legislation is bipartisan, and so it shows that there is broad support for these issues. And I think what's important to note is that big money in politics is a problem for everyday voters of both political parties. And so regardless of political affiliation, wealthy special interests look out for their own interests and not those of everyday Americans. And so I think the success of this proposal is that it's continuing to pound the drumbeat that Americans are tired of the system being rigged against them, and they are looking for change, and that legislators should support this change. I know sometimes the issue of money in politics can feel frustrating, but this is an excellent opportunity to call your legislator and say, there is a package of reforms called the We the People Act, and I would like you to support it, and I would like you to make this happen. So this is a good moment for folks to continue to make noise on this issue.
Rachel, I'll just end on this question here. Many people across the country are pretty cynical about politics and about the role of big money, Wall Street money, pharmaceutical money, health insurance company money. All that seems to be calling the shots in Washington when it comes to important policy decisions. What, if anything, gives you optimism that there's a change of mood in the country, or maybe on Capitol Hill too, that gives this legislation a fighting chance?
I have always been an optimistic person, but I came to Washington anyway, and I love working here because I can see that there are solutions. And even though it does seem like an insurmountable problem, this piece of legislation is one piece in a large puzzle of solutions that can happen, and our democracy can be restored. The balance can sort of be reset, and we can have a democracy that is reflective of what our communities actually look like. And so I think what I'll say is that a lot of folks may not think that there are solutions, and it does seem like an issue that can't be addressed. But this is one step, the We the People Act, but this is one in a plan of lots of organizations from across the country that are working on. And the Democracy Awakening event was just the beginning. I think the movement is growing, and I think that the time is now that we can take back our democracy.
That was Rachel Curley, Democracy Associate with Public Citizens Congress Watch. Find links to more information on the We the People Democracy Reform legislation by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. One of the most effective groups that worked to stop the northern leg of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline from Canada into the U.S. was Bold Nebraska. Founded by Nebraskan Jane Klebb, it brought together farmers, ranchers, and members of indigenous nations to carry out many audacious and creative actions. These protests included building a barn powered by renewable energy directly in the path of the planned pipeline, and organizing the Cowboy and Indian Alliance, which set up a week-long encampment on the Mall in Washington, D.C., taking their fight to President Obama, who finally killed the Keystone XL project in November 2015. Bold Nebraska is now broadening its reach, both in terms of geography and the fossil fuels it's targeting. The group initiated a project called Bold Alliance, a network of citizen action groups in rural states, whose mission is to assist activists across the U.S. fight interstate frack gas pipelines and other gas infrastructure projects. In early June, Native and non-Native members traveled east to symbolically plant sacred corn seeds on the proposed paths of two pipelines in Virginia and West Virginia. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Art Tanderup, a retired teacher and anti-pipeline activist, who now farms 160 acres in northern Nebraska on a farm that's been in his wife's family for generations. He participated in the recent planting of the sacred corn in Virginia. Here, Tanderup describes his involvement in protesting the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline and the move to expand Bold Nebraska's outreach to fossil fuel pipeline opponents across the country.
In November of 2013, we held an activity here on our farm. It was the first of the spirit camps that were held with the Cowboy Indian Alliance. Ours was the Ponca Trail of Tears Spirit Camp, because part of our farm is on the Ponca Trail of Tears, where the Ponca were driven from north of us up here at Niobrara to Oklahoma with Chief Standing Bear and his people.
A group of you has taken some sacred Ponca corn to plant along the paths of other proposed pipelines far from Nebraska. Why did you decide to do that?
This week has been really exciting with that. We had 3 days, and we did two sites a day, and we did four sites in Virginia and two sites in West Virginia. We went to those places. You know, they're fighting the same thing, the corporate greed, the total disrespect for property rights, and they're obviously not thinking much about the future of this earth and, you know, the damage that they're doing with climate change and so forth. So we had gatherings at six farms. We kind of explained the history of this corn and what we're doing with it, and then we did some of the Ponca ceremony at each site, and then we planted corn and always closed with a prayer of thanksgiving. So a very spiritual thing as well as an exciting action.
So this is taking the fight against the KXL, the tar sands pipeline, and using the same kind of tactics against frack gas pipelines. That seems like a really important development.
Yes, it is, exactly. And everybody told us it couldn't be done with KXL. You know, a lot of groups, a lot of people work together. And, you know, one of the things that Jane was so good at was creating unlikely alliances with all the different groups and individuals out here. And that was so important. And we all focused on one thing, and that was stopping this. And part of what we did was to give these people some hope, the spirit that they could actually do this. It isn't totally overwhelming. They are Americans, they have rights, and they can stop these things. You know, the corporations don't need to run this country. It's just like Keystone. There are so many issues with it, you know, the eminent domain and property rights, you know, the climate change issue. You know, you just go on and on and on with the different issues with, around these pipelines. They can be stopped.
And these pipelines were the Mountain Valley and the Atlantic Coast pipelines, right?
Yes, those were the two that we, yeah,
okay.
That we were at.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
We did talk a lot about the 1718 various pipeline projects. They're growing like weeds. You know, they're all over the place, and they're all intended for export. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they've all got to be stopped.
Many proposed pipelines are headed to Dominion's Cove Point LNG export facility, which is under construction right now in Lusby, Maryland. And local people, supported by some outside groups, are trying to stop it, since it will affect everyone on the planet if these enormous methane emissions from bringing the gas in and liquefying it are allowed to happen. So, Art Tandrup, you've described Bold Nebraska as the mothership, but this bold concept is expanding. Can you talk about that?
You know, what was decided was that there are issues in other states. So now in a few states, we started like Bold Iowa, to fight the Bakken pipeline, Bold Oklahoma to deal with the fracking and the earthquake issue and that sort of thing down there. There's a Bold Louisiana. And the states have been selected that really need the help right now. And then, you know, and they all come under the umbrella of Bold Alliance.
That was Art Tandrup, a farmer and activist with the group Bold Nebraska. Learn more about Bold Nebraska and their Bold Alliance initiative by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Solitary, author's world. His name is Arthur Johnson, and he has lived in his cell in the hole for 37 years. You heard me right. 37 years. He was first cast into the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections version of Hell, officially known as solitary confinement, in December 1979. Jimmy Carter was president. The Shah of Iran had just been overthrown by the Islamic Revolution. Tennis star John McEnroe won his first U.S. Open championship. Muhammad Ali wasn't just alive. He had recently retired from the boxing ring. From that time to this very day, Arthur Johnson has been in continuous solitary confinement, locked in the hole, and virtually forgotten until now. Recently, the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, filed an Eighth Amendment challenge to Johnson's continuous solitary confinement and seeks an injunction in federal court. For 37 years, Johnson has lived in the hole, held in a 7-by-12-feet cell, held 23 hours a day, an hour is allowed, in an outdoor cage, for an alleged attempted escape in 1979. Facing conditions such as these, the question arises, who wouldn't want to escape? For 37 years, he hasn't touched a woman's hand, held a child in his arms, hugged a relative, or entered a classroom, prayed in a religious congregation, or walked more than 10 feet without being handcuffed or shackled. He's lived in, if you can call this living, nearly a dozen prisons: Forest, Huntington, Smithfield, Graterford, Green, back to Huntington, but always only in the hole, never in general population, never free of handcuffs, chains, and shackles. When he came to prison, he was 18. He's 63 now. That's the face of Pennsylvania corrections. That's the reality of solitary confinement, the whole. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. John Bernie. For millions of people, the demise of the Bernie Sanders campaign has led to a political depression, for the two parties have thrown up perhaps the least popular candidates in memory. That is not to say they don't have their supporters, for they do. It's just that both candidates, Donald J. Trump and Hillary Rodham Clinton, have daunting negatives. And that both candidates possess inordinate wealth is to be counted against them, not for them. For this has been a political season of pronounced distrust and distaste of the wealthy. For some, these choices prove the inherent corruption of the political system, which, post the Citizens United decision, has swung more towards wealth than at any time in recent history. These views are reflected more among the young than their elders, for youth tend more toward idealism. But that idealism, that hope, that deep hunger for change, doesn't have to die. Sure, Sanders' presidential hopes have been dashed. But what of the movement that brought him to the table? The issues of a more honest political system, of a more humanistic as opposed to more corporatist healthcare system, the call for an end to mass incarceration, the demand to halt police terror. These issues, not a specific candidate, moved millions. Why not form a new political party? Why not organize a mass political movement? Why not? Why not? The present political system has failed millions. Why does it continue to deserve your support? When the great labor leader, Joe Hill, was being led to the gallows in Utah, he told his friends, don't waste time mourning. Organize. Don't mourn Bernie's failure to win the presidency. Organize. To quote that great Pan-African leader, Kwame Ture, organize, organize, and organize. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Convicted in 1984 of a homicide robbery of a man who he argued had attacked him sexually. During his post-conviction hearing, a Philadelphia judge found the DA had improperly sanitized the victim by hiding evidence of his relationships with young men for years. Such an act, said this judge, invalidated Williams' death sentence. Predictably, the DA appealed, and just as predictably, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, composed of ex-prosecutors, including the man who initially decided to seek the death penalty, reversed the trial court and reinstated Butter's death sentence. Butter's lawyers appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and on Thursday, June 9th, they issued their startling ruling. In a 5-3 decision written by Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy, the court held that former DA and former Chief Justice Ronald Castile should have recused himself from Butter's appeal, and further, His failure to do so violated the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Butter's case thus became the law of the land and a warning to courts to recuse judges who played pivotal roles in prosecutions. Such a ruling was poo-pooed by Castile, who described his role, that is, authorizing prosecution of a death penalty case, as merely procedural. Butter, who now suffers from serious psychological disturbances, isn't off the proverbial hot seat. The current DA is going to try to return him to death row. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
All right. How you doing? This is Michael Slate. Welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm really excited about today's show. Right? We've got a great lineup for you. But there's something I wanted to read first because I always end up – this stuff always ends up getting pushed to the back end of the show, and I don't want to have it lost there, okay? And in the wake of all the fuss that's been going on about elections and all this other stuff, there's something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, that I thought would be very cool to read today and sort of set a different tone out there, and people can write to me and tell me what they think about it. All right, here it goes. The much-proclaimed democracy under this system is a sham, and worse – it promotes the illusion that it is expressing the will of the people while really involving the people in legitimizing the rule of a rapacious and murderous class of capitalist imperialists who dominate and shape the electoral process and political decision-making overall and whose rule is in reality a dictatorship that fundamentally relies on brutally oppressive force and violence. Once again, something to think about. And that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. All right, so for today's show, at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking about debtors' prisons in the U.S. And joining us, there's an ACL lawsuit in Washington State that recently succeeded in ending the practice of locking people up for unpaid court costs in Benton County, Washington. But these debtors' prisons are common in many states across the country. And we're going to be talking with Prachi Dave, a staff attorney at the ACLU of Washington State, and Nusrat Chowdhury, staff attorney for the ACLU in New York City. All right, so we'll be talking about that at the back end of the show. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to really bring you a segment that I did. I recorded just last week with Jerry Lemke talking with us about his latest book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America, the question of PTSD's post-traumatic stress disorder, which was first formulated following the Vietnam War, is still as current and controversial as ever. And Jerry Lemke shows how medical talk about PTSD is used to undercut the powerful actions of anti-war GIs and veterans from Vietnam to the war in Iraq. Jerry Lemke is an associate professor of emeritus of sociology at the College of Holy Cross and the author of The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. So without any further ado, Teddy, let's hit it. Let's listen to Jerry Lemke. Back a little while ago, I interviewed a man named Jerry Lemke, and it was about his book, The Spitting Image, which actually I was really, really happy to be turned on to when I worked with David Zeiger on his film, Sir, No Sir. And The Spitting Image was about this mythology of what was happening to Vietnam vets by anti-war people in the U.S. when they returned from the war. And it was a whole mythology that was built. It was part of basically, I think it was part of this whole reactionary trend to try and sum up this or to try to break this influence what was developing as a really very important relationship between anti-war vets and veterans and the anti-war movement as it stood that in those days. In the course of reading that book and then later talking with Jerry about it, I came across his book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. And Jerry Lemke, he's just written a very powerful book there again. He's Associate Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts. And I'm very pleased to welcome you to the show, Jerry.
Good to be with you again.
Well, let's jump into it because, man, I have got like 18 pages of questions for you, okay?
All right, that's like, good.
Yeah, it's very heavy here. So this whole question of PTSD, it is controversial. It's still very much alive today. I was just talking with my assistant producer, and we were remarking about how in the LA Times, either yesterday or the day before, was a whole big story about vets in the U.S. and how they're being hooked up with horses and training horses and riding horses and taking care of horses as a way to relieve their PTSD.
So, oh, my.
Yeah.
Look forward to seeing that.
Yeah. So it's very much alive today in terms of war and veterans. What is it and where did it come from?
Oh, well, I think it's good, first of all, that you began with a reference to the book, The Spitting Image, because I think that both of these, the mythology of spat upon veterans and this narrative of wounded veterans, people coming home from war, traumatized, are really two parts of the same story. They both work to construct an image of veterans as victims, and both of those worked particularly in the 70s and maybe in the 80s, actually it still works today, really to offset or to displace the idea that war can be a very politicizing and very empowering experience for men who are sent off to war. Certainly that was the case with Vietnam veterans. Many of us, I say us because I'm one of them, came home from Vietnam really very much ready to join the anti-war movement. we didn't think of ourselves as victims at all. We didn't think of ourselves as traumatized at all. And most historians find that we were a very important part of the anti-war movement. Now, if you run the clock ahead to the 1990s after the first Persian Gulf War, and even more today after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you ask the question, so why aren't people coming home from these wars the way Vietnam veterans came home with this attitude of ready to traumatize Richard Nixon when we came home? What has happened in between? And I think that what happened then, and we go back and decide this new image got created. The media, Hollywood played a huge role in this, portraying Vietnam veterans as pretty much damaged goods and not portraying the political images of Vietnam veterans at all. So the culture really pushed off screen the idea of Vietnam veterans as political actors, put in place Vietnam veterans as victims, and that image of how men come home from war then is what really caught on with this new generation of veterans, and more important than that, really caught on with the American public. The subtitle of my book is Diagnosis and Identity. It's the identity word in there that I think is most important, and I'm sure we'll get to this, we'll come back to this, but the idea of trauma, the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder almost being a credential for the wartime experience, and it's something that people now expect veterans to come home with, expect our soldiers to come home displaying these symptoms of having been stressed out. So the whole imagery has really gotten inverted. And I think that there are greater even political consequences to that, which I'm sure we'll come back to.
Mm-hmm. Now, just so we can get this out of the way in the beginning, pretty quick in your book, you make the point that it's not whether PTSD is real, but rather that the labeling of conditions and symptoms as PTSD, and that you see a reality far greater than the reality given by medical science. What are you talking about there?
Well, the medical science of it stems from, I hope I don't lose your listeners here, but stems from a positivist notion of science, that is that there is something out there to be found, you know, a set of conditions that we can find, and then we go from there if we are medical scientists. You know, that's what the idea of a diagnosis is really based on. But there's a whole other take on the medical profession, and that is comes out of what's called the social constructionist literature, really informed by literary traditions, informed particularly by anthropology and by sociology, which says that all of this stuff is more subjective, right? It's not so much as if doctors and other people find something out there. It's that they define what they see out there and to some extent find out there what they go out there looking for. So there's much more of a making of these diagnostic conditions, these diagnostic categories, than there is a finding of those. And what I argue in the book is that, and your words really pick it up very nicely, it's not as though PTSD is not real. The question is, what is its reality? What is its reality? And I argue that its most important reality is political and cultural. That PTSD, the category, PTSD, the concept, has some validity as a diagnostic concept, but it has greater power in the way it works culturally and politically. And that's really what the book is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into that, because you also talk about how this has been honed into a medical alternative to the political discourse of the anti-war veterans movement, which is a pretty powerful statement and one that I think is really important today.
That's kind of what I started with, I think, in the first thing I said here in the interview is that it's a different way of looking at war veterans. It's a different set of terms, a different kind of terminology, a different mode of discourse, right? A different way of talking about veterans who are home. Again, the Vietnam veterans come home very political, very much empowered by the wartime experience. They're out in the streets. They've joined the anti-war movement. And a lot of people, including some medical people, mental health medical people looked at that and said, that's really a disturbing behavior. That really doesn't conform to the norms of the way veterans come home. So they began to think about this, right, begin to think about these veterans as people with mental health problems, talking about their political activity as a form of acting out, as a form of catharsis, that these guys are in the streets because they're looking for a way of expressing their emotional upset because of the war, and they're trying to find a new kind of stability in their mental health. And so that, as the anti-war movement wound down, right, and that sort of fades away, and its discourse, which Vietnam veterans had adopted, that discourse begins to fade away. This mental health discourse becomes more and more popular. The press in particular, the New York Times in particular, plays a very great role in putting this new set of terminology into place. That Vietnam veterans are not so much to be listened to politically, but they're to be sympathetic toward, right? These are people who need help, not people who are who have come back from the war ready to help us end the war, right, which is the way things were in the really early years of the 1970s. And so as the years go along, and again, Hollywood plays a huge role in this, in portraying Vietnam vets really as damaged, as dangerous, even sexually deranged figures like Travis Bickle, you know, in the Taxi film. Lots of characters like that in the portrayal of Vietnam veterans in Hollywood films.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very heavy because a friend of mine, I was talking with her before I left to do this interview, and we were talking, but she had worked with a lot of veterans in Hawaii, and particularly during the Gulf War years, the first Gulf War, and then a little bit later than that, the second one as well. The part of what she was talking about, she said, you know, look, that she worked, there were a lot of Vietnam veterans there who really used to always pose to her that what we should be saying to these guys is, hey, you know what? You want to talk about all the trauma that you went through. You want to talk about this. You want to talk about that. Actually, I'd like to pose to you, if you were piloting the Enola Gay, should you talk about the trauma that was caused to you, or what about the nuclear bomb that you dropped on so many people and were responsible for incinerating so many people? When you look at that, there's a real pull, and I think this is part of this thing of what the impact on the movement generally, because there was a very strong relationship between the overall political movement, the radical and revolutionary political movement, and what was going on among the Vietnam vets, sort of separating that off and making people sort of cop to more, I'm physically damaged, I'm mentally damaged, and it's me and what I'm doing. And it shifts the question from the nature of the war to the warriors, which is something that you actually...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's something you really hit on hard.
One of the origins of that shift was President Carter in the late 70s kind of, I think, maybe coined this phrase, mutual destruction or something like that, that both the United States and Vietnam had suffered mutually from the effects of the war, which, of course, was and is a real fiction. But one of the pieces of that, right, and by the late 70s, this was beginning to creep into the American conversation, was what happened to our men who we sent off to fight the war. You know, look how damaged they have come home. Look over what we have sacrificed for that war. So that was one of the beginning points for this. Now, another twist on this, though, and this twist plays even bigger today, is that the trauma that we inflict on other people, particularly the atrocities that we inflict on other people in Vietnam or in Iraq or in Afghanistan, those get interpreted as being then traumatic experiences of the people who did the inflicting. Much of the mental health literature today is about the trauma that our soldiers have experienced in their experience of inflicting trauma on other people. A great deal of it is that way. And while this is on my mind, too, and this isn't quite on point of this particular question that you ask, but again, particularly with Vietnam, and we're also picking up, again, on this today, some of the trauma, a lot of the trauma, actually, on Vietnam vets was supposedly endured in the coming home experience. And you see, there again is a tie to the myth of being spat on, that we came home from Vietnam, we weren't welcomed, there weren't parades, we were forgotten, we weren't taken care of, and maybe we were treated badly by the anti-war movement, according to the stories. So that was a traumatic experience. Now, it just occurred to me as I was about to say that there's another new book out. Sebastian Younger's book came out just a few weeks ago, reviewed in Sunday's New York Times, that we need to do better about welcoming our veterans back. Now, I haven't read his book, but I did read his article in Vanity Fair magazine, by the way, about a year ago, I think. There's a theme in there. There's a subtext in there that somehow we're not doing right by our people when they come home. And this is part of the problematic mental health experience that the entire war experience leaves with our veterans. It's the coming home experience. It's the after-war experience. It's what happens after we send them off to do this terrible damage, right, to these other people. It's what happens there. And, of course, finally, and I'm sure this is part of your question, too, it really writes out of our history, writes out. It erases, it elides from our memory what these wars were really about, right? And certainly the people who are victims of these wars in other countries. That's really gone. And we end up talking about our own soldiers. We end up talking about our own veterans rather than what the politics of the war, politics and economics of the war, what it was really about.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jerry Lemke. And we're talking about his really powerful book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. And I'm telling you, folks, you got to get this book. You got to read it, all right? Because especially the times that we're living in today, you absolutely have to be.
By the way, it's out in a new paperback edition, so it's a little less expensive than what the original hardcover was.
Okay, good. I don't care if they had to pay a bucket of gold for it, though. They need to read it. Okay, that's the thing.
Oh, thanks for that.
Sure, definitely. Well, let's jump into something else around here, because I do.
Sure.
I definitely don't want to leave out this question of the role of culture, the overall cultural scene in this country in relation to what's being promoted around both PTSD and the current thing, which we should talk about first probably, is the current version of PTSD, which is traumatic brain injury. Let's talk about that, the link between those. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, first of all, the big cultural piece on this, and I just want to prompt you on this in case, you know, we otherwise wouldn't get back to it, but the other wording in my subtitle is post-empire America.
Mm-hmm. I think that
this trauma narrative really plays into that in very, very dangerous ways. But again, that's something that we can come back to. The traumatic brain injury part on this is so interesting. And gosh, I think what listeners need to do is they need to connect that up with shell shock of the World War I period. In the book, I quote a Washington Post reporter as saying that traumatic brain injury, TBI, we'll shorthand that, TBI has brought back one of the worst afflictions of World War I, shell shock. That's pretty much a quote right from the book. The irony in that is that shell shock, even by the end of World War I, was completely discredited as a diagnostic category. And so to say that TBI now brings that back, people who know that history, that mental health history, kind of look at that and say, that's a strange thing to be saying, because this reporter was very much into kind of promoting the legitimacy and the validity of TBI, but he obviously doesn't know that history. But here's the takeaway question, right, on TBI. You got to ask yourself, what is the word traumatic doing in there? What is the T in there? We know there's such a thing as brain injury. Car accident, your skull hits the dashboard, the brain hits the skull, you have a brain injury. That's a concussion, all right? That is a biological, organic a condition. So you don't need the word trauma in that, right? If you have a brain injury, you could say, well, of course a brain injury is traumatic, right, or can be traumatic. And why does it get added in when it gets added in? And by the way, I did the research on this. It's a very late addition. It really only comes sometime around in the 1990s. So all this history of war injuries, brain injuries in war, of course brain injuries in war, none of it has the word trauma or traumatic attached to it until the 1980s. Now, here's what happens, is that this concept of PTSD, as we've already talked about, is problematic, right? It's biological or it's organic. Validity is just not there. People have been looking, since the term came into play in around 1980, went into the DSM in 1980, people have been looking for some sort of biomarker, is the term that they look for, something that will prove to their satisfaction, right, that PTSD is real, that in some minds, some medical, mental health minds, it's really not real until it shows up on a microscope, right? There's got to be something. So what they went looking for was this biomarker, this kind of the holy grail, right, of PTSD. Now, it's the link between PTSD and brain injury. The word traumatic is in there to create the idea that PTSD, which we'll say now is trauma qua trauma, psychological, emotional disorder, right, of a psychological nature, right, mm-hmm. causes some sort of brain injury, causes something that is organic, something that is biological, something that would be the biomarker. So the search now, right, is to find some kind of link between PTSD and brain injury. So the word trauma in there is a kind of a bridge term, supposedly, ostensibly, to connect the two up. But as of my last reading of the literature, it's not there. I mean, there are articles that you can read, you know, and there are newspaper stories that, you know, that might have the headline that kind of give you the impression that, aha, they found it. But you read into the story and you know, what you see is all the qualifications that the research still has a long way to go and so on and so forth. So it's not there. Will it ever be there? I'm skeptical, but then I'm not a quote unquote scientist, right? In that sense, there are people who say that yes, you know, emotional upset can leave traces in the brain, and those can be permanent. Can be? Well, anytime you say can be, you know, it's a maybe, and it's the other side of that is, well, maybe not. Right. That's where I think that's at. And I think that's what listeners need to, that question of why is trauma there? Who puts that word trauma there? How is the word trauma in that position supposed to function? Culturally speaking, that's really your question, I think. How does it work? How does it work in the American conversation? How does it work in American culture?
You know, it's something very important in terms of the character of the wars, what happened in the aftermath of the wars, the losing of the Vietnam War, just the horror that's been inflicted on the people all throughout the world, in the Middle East in particular, and the inability of the U.S. to declare sort of another great victory and bring Caesar, a new crown to Caesar in D.C., right? The basic point is that there's a whole thing here of this. What I'm bringing that up for is because, one, there's a lot to dig into there, but there's a particular element which I find very troubling and important for our listeners here is that in the midst of all this, particularly lately, and since there's been the Iraq veterans against the war and then these various hearings that developed and the people themselves, there's been a unity between a lot of what the right is saying in society about the wounded warriors and the importance of taking care of them and, you know, standing with them, and what the left has been saying a lot, using the wounded warriors as a way to sort of have a backdoor into a conversation with people. But it promotes, to me,
absolutely,
it ends up promoting the same thing.
I think that's right. I think that if what you're saying, that it's sort of a right woos left, to use Chip Berlay's term, right woos left. The right comes up with this stuff that's very seductive. And some people on the left, you know, particularly the liberal left, buy into that and play into that. The real danger here is that this wounded warrior stuff, the victim-veteran stuff, the traumatized, traumatized veteran stuff, is really a metaphor for a wounded nation, a traumatized people, a traumatized nation. And again, what listeners have to do to make sense of this, you go back to post-World War I Germany. The shell-shocked German veteran in Germany was a metaphor for the wounded Germany. And it played out that way in German literature. It played out that way in early German film in the 1920s. There's a great, great book on this called Shell Shock Cinema. Listeners have got to get that book. It's called Shell Shock Cinema, subtitled Weimar Germany and something. Because once you see that, then you think about what's going on in the United States today and you say, oh my God, right? It's the same thing. We are much more slowly than it happened in Germany, but we are slowly being moved by that wounded nation narrative. That there's two features of this. One is that we need to rehab ourselves, find our new confidence by rearming, by going back into the war, by showing ourselves, first of all, that we are the right stuff, showing ourselves that we could have won the last war if we had not been sold out on the home front. That, of course, played heavily in World War I Germany, also as the stab in the back legend, right?
Yeah.
We can do all that again. But what plays even more powerfully today is that so much of our understanding of how these wars abroad are being fought is based on psychological operations, psychological warfare, propaganda, stealth. I mean, you almost really can't talk about terrorism except as stealth, as sneakiness, as the dangers of the unseen, right? That's what terrorism is all about. You know, what's the real damage of terrorism, right? It's terror. We're terrorized. We're traumatized, we Americans. So seeing our enemy in that way as a traumatizing enemy, that licenses then our use of similar kinds of warfare, drone warfare, right? Why is it justified? Well, we're fighting terrorists. We're fighting people who struck us first using the implements of terror, and so we strike back in that same kind of way. And that's why the words post-empire America are in the subtitle of my book. Post-empire. We are living through the throes, the pangs of a post-empire period of history, and there is somewhat of a rule of thumb, right, that empires in decline are very, very dangerous, very, very vicious political animals. And we really need to consider that is the path that we have placed ourselves on with this trauma narrative. And back to your point, the imagery, the storyline, the coming home storyline of veterans as traumatized, as hurt, as damaged, damages and injuries that are unseen, the unseen wound, all of this stuff is a playground, right, for the imaginations of a nation itself, a people itself that is traumatized and needs to get back on its horse and go back into war. Mm-hmm. It's very, very dangerous.
Now, just in relation to this, I just want to actually go back to a point that you've been making a lot about the role of culture and culture in playing all this, because, you know, you mentioned a couple things in your book that I wanted to dig into a little. And one is the story of Kimberly Dozier and her book and who she was and what happened to her. And frankly, she was a really stand alone and stand out example of what people should be looking for in the society today in relation to people who have, you know, are speaking out about this war and what happens there. And then you also talk about something which I think is shocking on the other end of it, the role of things like HBO, MTV, the broader culture, the culture that actually is so many, you know, I mean, when you say HBO and MTV, you feel like you're talking about 10 times the U.S. population, you know, the way it goes out all over the world. And what was portrayed there in terms of Kanye West and what he did, and then James Gandolfini and what he did. You know, these are very important things that people don't necessarily connect up with, you know, this whole dying empire, you know, this post-empire America. So let's talk about Kimberly Dozier first and then that.
Kimberly Dozier was a CBS News reporter who was badly wounded in Iraq, very badly wounded in Iraq. And her story, briefly, the important part of her story is one of doctors trying to cast her in this PTSD role. She was physically very, very damaged. And so they kept prompting her, right, to counter the coming effects of PTSD. And she kept saying, I'm not going to go down that road, which didn't mean that she didn't have her scary moments and all this. She writes about all this in the book. But in the end, she's really a stand-up person whose case really exposes the imposition of PTSD by mental health professionals on people, and how strong in this case somebody had to be in order to push back on that. And I contrast her case in the book with that of Bob Woodruff, the ABC correspondent, who was also injured in an explosion in Iraq, but much, much less seriously than Kimberly Dozier was. And he, as I write about it, he plays right into that, right? And he's one of the key figures in the story of how TBI, traumatic brain injury, comes to be viewed as such a valid notion. And I think it plays a huge part. And I show in the book how the number of citations in the mental health journals increases after Bob Woodruff's story airs as a major primetime viewing story on ABC. And after his book comes out, with number one bestseller, his book, on the New York Times bestseller list, his book on basically how he comes to identify with and be identified with traumatic brain injury. And I really go through that book and I really deconstruct that story. And so in my book, then, I counterpose the Bob Woodruff story with the Kimberly Dozier story. And there are other ways that you allude to. There's great stuff, the Kanye West program on, maybe you can help me
MTV.
Out here. Okay, MTV, yes. And he, you know, he does this visitation, unannounced visitation to Iraq War veterans who have been diagnosed with PTSD. And he visits them, and then, of course, he invites them to his next concert, and they get to meet Pharrell and all these other stars. So, of course, I mean, it makes Kanye West look like a great guy, right? But it also has a way, very powerful way, of validating, particularly for young people who are watching this show, for crying out loud, validating the diagnostic properties of traumatic brain injury and of PTSD. I mean, PTSD is all part of the same story. So I write about that in some detail. I write about it. So I think readers will find that kind of interesting as a deconstruction of popular culture, really.
Exactly, and the need to really pay attention in those arenas. And one last question, and we have about 3 minutes for you to answer it, so I know it's not fair, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Embrace the Horror. What a great name for the last chapter of this book, all right? What's going on here?
Well, yeah, thanks for that. I'm glad you liked it. That line comes from Apocalypse Now. If we're going to win these wars, we need to be as horrific as our enemies. We need to be able to do all the atrocious things that our enemies do. That was the line, and that was the narrative, one of the narratives that came out of that movie, Apocalypse Now. And what I'm saying in that chapter is that we are back. That is where we went after the 1978 movie, Apocalypse Now. We went in that direction, and that direction has taken us to where we are now. I mean, we even celebrate now, for crying out loud. We celebrate a lot of the losses in war. Again, that's That's part of the credentialing of the real warrior, right? The guy who comes home as an amputee or the guy who comes home psychologically damaged. That's what we want to see because that validates who we are as a people. We can send our people off to suffer damage just as much as our enemies can. And that's really the point of that chapter. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the drone warfare and how so much of that is carried out now by these people who sit in Las Vegas, New Jersey, or North Carolina, or Texas, or wherever, and they basically end up firing off drones from the safety of that, where they never see up front what's going on. And the people in these villages and whatnot living under this constant terror, you know, which is really horrific. If you ever look into how these drone strikes are carried out, you know, they hit once and then they wait for people to come out and see if they can, how their relatives are doing. Is there anybody left alive or needing help? And then they come in and hit again. And all day before the drones even are fired off, any particular drone, while they're all they sort of cruise the sky, leaving people to wonder exactly when is it going to fall, exactly when is it going to hit. So people live in terror as they see the war, as they see the drone missile, and then they see at the same time they live in the aftermath of that, which is even more horrible. Let's talk about that a minute in relation to what you're talking about just now.
Oh well, I think your words capture very well what is going on the ground for those people. What's really interesting is that PTSD has come to be applied to the people who are flying those drones from Arizona or Montana or wherever they sit. And I think that's part of the need of maybe not even so much the need for them, but the need for the American people to understand to understand what they're doing as being real warfare and of them as being real warriors. So again, the supposed mental health condition of trauma is a way of credentialing their warriorhood. Yeah. And then the stuff is really insidious, right? The people involved, in this case, the people who are flying the drones, do pick this stuff up, right, and adopt it as an identity for themselves. It's almost irresistible, I think, when the culture almost demands that you see yourself in the way that the culture sees you, right, that it's hard to resist. And we know this, right, from other kinds of class studies of racial identities, that the dominant culture is very, very powerful. British PTSD rates are about 1/4 of those from Americans. And some British scholars say it's because Americans expect their soldiers to come home traumatized. And so the soldiers play to that expectation. I mean, it's good old-fashioned sociology. Wow. There's no reason to think that drone pilots, right, aren't affected, and you could say affected in very negative ways by the same thing, yeah, right, that they take on those identities for themselves and probably end up in a psychiatrist's office, right, being treated for war trauma.
All right, Jerry Lemke, thank you very much, man. Thank you very much for the book and for coming on and doing this interview.
All right. You're very welcome.
Okay. All right. Talk to you again soon. Stay in touch, man.
Sure. All right. Bye.
Thanks. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Jerry Lemke, the author of PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. All right. It's a very, very heavy book. And Jerry is an associate professor emeritus of sociology at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts. And his other books include The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, and Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and the Fantasies of Betrayal. Once again, that's Jerry Lemke. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Breaking up big rocks on a chain gang. Breaking rocks and saving my time. Breaking rocks, I tell, on a chain gang. Cause I've been convicted of crime. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. Yeah, I reckon that ought to get it. Been working and working, but I still got so terrible long to go. I commit the crime, Lord, I need it. Crime of being hungry and poor. Left the grocery store man bleeding when he caught me robbing his store. Hold it steady right there while I hit it. I reckon that ought to get it in a wicket and a wicket. But I still got so terrible long to go. And did you say 5 years hard labor on the chain gang, you Guanaco? I heard the judge say 5 years labor
the table long ago.
All right, all right. Welcome back. That's Oscar Brown Jr., the late Oscar Brown Jr., with Work Song. And that's a perfect intro to our next segment because we're going to be talking about, yes, get ready for it, folks, debtors' prisons, all right? Yeah, I know. I was kind of shocked, too, when I heard it. But I actually found out the extent of all this. I found that out because I saw an article in the L.A. Times talking about an ACLU lawsuit in Washington State that recently succeeded in ending the practice of locking people up for unpaid court costs in Benton County. And it talked about these debtors' prisons being very common in many states in the U.S. And I thought, what the hell? Really? So I wanted to talk to people about this. Right? And I found two people that I was really excited to be able to reach out to and to talk to. And first is Prachi Dave, who's the staff attorney of the ACLU of Washington State. And we're also going to be joined by Nusrat Chowdhury, who's the staff attorney for the ACLU in New York. Prachi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Nusrat, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, sure. And Nusrat, I'm going to start by asking Prachi some questions first, just so we can get a little bit of the particulars about what happened in Benton County, Washington, because that was kind of a mind blower. Prachi, what actually did happen?
Well, we had found through several months of investigation that what Benton County was doing is instituting a practice of jailing or threatening to jail or forcing manual labor on people who couldn't afford their legal financial obligations that were imposed on them by the county. So what we had found is that at least over a snapshot of time, so over a six-month period of time, at least 320 people were jailed in the Benton County Jail simply because they were too poor to pay the legal financial obligations imposed on them by the county. And when we talk about the legal financial obligations, we're just talking about the money that was owed as part of the sentence. Many of these individuals had completed all of the other aspects of any of the sentences that they had in the county.
Boy, so basically, when you talk about numbers of people, is this really prevalent? What are the numbers involved here?
Well, in the complaint for Benton County, we listed the 320 people who we had investigated over that six-month period of time. But considering the length of time that these practices have continued, we estimate that these numbers are in the thousands.
Wow, in the thousands. Well, let's talk about one particular person, just so people can get a sense of what's going on. Jane Fuentes.
Yeah, so Janie Fuentes is one of the plaintiffs as part of our lawsuit, and she is a great example of the number of different kinds of impacts that debtor's prison system like the one run by Benton County can have on the individual. One of the things that Janie experienced was that when she was released from her sentence in 2013, she was unemployed, she was disabled, and she was trying to get her life together. However, the county kept on coming after her for these legal financial obligations. So even though she was unemployed, she was expected to pay legal financial obligations to the county, and she wasn't able to get her life back together. She constantly had warrants issued for her arrest, which meant that she would have to keep on going back to jail or labor on work crew, when in fact she could have been spending all of that time looking for employment for herself, looking for stable housing. And these are really the ways that legal financial obligations set people like Janie Fuentes back and don't allow them to move forward from these convictions that they put behind them a very long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, the ACLU recently went to court over this. Can you tell people sort of in a concentrated way, what was your court case? What were you pressing? What were you fighting? And you won. What does that mean?
Well, the court case was an attempt to go after the entire system that had been instituted by the county. The things that we had found that the county was imprisoning people and placing them on work crew, basically manual labor, because they couldn't pay. But they weren't determining any whether or not they could pay. They weren't looking at their poverty levels. They weren't looking at the fact that many of these individuals were on disability or below the poverty line. That kind of analysis was not being done on an individual basis before these individuals were jailed. That meant that many and just the majority of individuals who were caught up in this system were indigent. And so what the lawsuit intended to do was to put an end to that system by requiring that any time the county wanted to impose any kind of sanction because individuals were unable to pay their LFOs, requiring that the county does a detailed analysis of whether or not these people can actually pay their LFOs. Are they actually too poor to pay their LFOs? If they are too poor to pay these financial obligations, then what the settlement says is that they cannot face the kinds of sanctions that the county had imposed on them previously. And it does require that individuals can go back to court and ask for a waiver or reduction of their legal financial obligations, again, because they are too indigent, they are unable to pay these legal financial obligations that were imposed on them. In addition, it does require that the main players, meaning the prosecution and the public defenders in the jurisdiction, are to undergo training so that these questions of ability to pay can be properly presented to the court, and these individuals who are looking at sanctions simply because they are unable to pay are properly represented.
All right, Prachi, we're going to move on to Nusrat for a minute now. And Nusrat, I wanted to talk to you about this because you can step back and look at this thing in a national context. What the hell is going on? Just what is debtor's prison and how prevalent is it? How widespread is this in the country today?
Well, yeah, your surprise is warranted because nearly two centuries ago, the United States formally abolished the incarceration of people who couldn't pay off debts owed in the civil context. But what we've witnessed is that especially since the economic recession, since 2010, that cities and counties, state courts around the country, urban and rural, north, south, spanning the Pacific Northwest to the Deep South, are in fact jailing people simply because they're too poor to pay court-imposed fines and fees. What we saw in Benton County were people who were recriminalized after serving their sentences and doing their time when they were saddled with these fines and fees related to their conviction. In other places, we see people criminalized simply because they can't pay fines and fees for traffic offenses, civil infractions, things that they wouldn't even normally carry jail time, yet they are being arrested and jailed simply because they're poor.
You know, it's just mind-blowing because I keep thinking about this and I'm thinking like, okay, how do they get away with this? You know, it reminds me of that story of Doug Blackman in his book, Slavery by Another Name, where he talked about how this had been going on after slavery had apparently, you know, had been supposedly defeated on one level, but it was actually being continued to be carried out in certain parts of the South. There was similar circumstances where people, if they were picked up and they didn't have enough money in their pocket to not be declared vagrant, then if they were declared vagrant, then they would end up being enslaved in these mines that supported the growth of the industry in the North. And he said that at one point, when Roosevelt was getting ready to go to war, and he said, all right, look, he had a meeting of his cabinet. He said, we have to figure out, okay, is there anything that somebody could pull our coattail on? Is there anything we really should know about that we could get into this war and we're supposed to be fighting for the high and mighty image and all this stuff of goodness? And is there anything that could maybe cause us a little problem? This guy in the corner said, yeah, there's this thing about slavery in the South. It's still going on. And you're kind of looking at this and you're thinking, what is it? When you're talking about the numbers of this, what's behind the push to do this? And how do they get away with this? Because you would think that, as you said, it was ruled unconstitutional, it was ruled illegal a long time ago. And there were other court cases that sort of reemphasized that, but yet it still goes on. What's happening here?
Well, the Supreme Court made clear more than 30 years ago that jailing people simply because they can't afford to pay a fine is contrary to core American values of fairness and equality embedded in the 14th Amendment. Yet what we've seen is that as public budgets have shrunk, as state governments have cut off funding for local governments, that there's this disturbing trend towards relying on the collection of court-imposed fines and fees as a source of revenue. And that revenue can be for a court or it can be for the government that runs the court, like a municipality. So we're seeing this rise in revenue generation at the expense of the poor, and there is no question that this creates a two-tiered system of justice, one that treats rich people and people of means far more fairly and with less punitive sanctions than those who are poor. And that two-tier system of justice is racially skewed. The Department of Justice highlighted this in its investigation of Ferguson. It concluded that the policing practices in that city were driven by a quest for revenue by the municipal government. And in a lawsuit filed by the ACLU in 2015 against DeKalb County, Georgia, we found exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about this in terms of the, you know, I keep thinking again, this is a lot bigger than I think anybody knows about or even people who have some inkling of it. It's sort of a little mind-boggling, as we were saying, and enraging. And I keep thinking about this thing of, you know, on the one hand, there's the argument, okay, well, and I know this is, you know, there's an argument built around this whole thing of, well, the more they have these debtors' prisons, the more they have bring people in here, that there's money that the states are that are getting, that the courts are getting. But there's also been quite a few examples, and I think even in the report that the ACLU did, there's a lot of examples where actually doing this, pursuing these debtors' prisons things, actually end up costing more money than they would ever get. It costs them more money than they would get than a person even owes. The thing I'm wondering is, like, there's a lot of this is not just tied up with it's not main. To me, it seems like, okay, you can say there's maybe a matter of revenue coming to the state or the counties or whatever, but there also seems this can't be separated from the overall, you know, repression that's going on, and particularly directed against Black and Latino people, and the whole thing of the new Jim Crow. Because you look at this kind of thing, and this is who's being targeted a lot. You know, poor people of color. And then you're kind of looking at it and you're thinking, okay, there's a lot of different ways that this falls out. Alice Goffman wrote about the impact of people not being able to pay their court fees when they're, or their, you know, what's going on with them, their fines or whatever in Philadelphia. And that means they don't show up for their new hearings. And so they end up going to jail once the police catch up for them, because there's a whole basis built on this. But there's a lot of this stuff that really actually to me seems to have a repressive aspect to it too.
Absolutely. I mean, we see again and again in places where the courts are focused on revenue generation rather than promoting public safety, that communities feel alienated and they fear calling the police. I've spoken to domestic violence survivors who, when they call the police for help, they were the ones who were arrested because they owed fines and fees, and that city was using arrest warrants to collect those debts. So rather than encouraging people to reach out to the police, these practices generate fear, distrust, and panic in low-income communities, and particularly communities of color. On your point on costs, you are correct. Too many courts and cities and counties aren't doing the math properly. Jailing people costs money. But what we've seen in places where we've investigated in depth and looked at the budgets is that the revenue generation is the result of people's families being panicked and in pure desperation, using public assistance funds, things that they would use for basic necessities just to get their loved ones out of jail. So maybe there is money coming in, but it's money that really should be going to support people's basic needs. And the real accounting isn't done, because they're simply not accounting for the cost of jailing and for diverting police officers from managing threats to public safety, from responding to calls for service, and turning them instead into debt collectors.
Well, debt collectors who are on vacation from their normal career of killing, okay, imprisoning. Let me ask you this. When you're talking about that, I want to know exactly, can you give us a sense of actually, I just need to get a sense of like the numbers of people. Are we talking millions of people that are getting caught up in this? And then the ACLU also has a project that they're doing around this. Can you tell us what that project is too?
Well, it's hard to quantify the numbers across the country, but as Prachi explained, in any given jurisdiction, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are being jailed or coerced to pay money that they can't afford to pay or subjected to manual labor. So we sued one Mississippi town where, in a simple 9-month span, more than 415 people had been booked to jail and were unable to pay anything and therefore were kept there. They were deprived of their liberty because they couldn't pay a fine or a fee. In Ferguson, like nearly most of the population had numerous warrants out against them and lots of people were jailed. So it's hard to kind of quantify exactly how many people, definitely in the thousands. And the question is, if we're getting to the millions, not sure. But what we do know is that the ACLU alone, and we're just one organization working on these issues, has exposed and challenged debtors' prisons in Colorado, Georgia, Louisiana, Maine, Michigan, Mississippi, New Hampshire, Ohio, Washington, and Florida. So these practices are widespread, and we need to look for them and challenge them everywhere they take place.
And how's it been going with the project you've been working on?
So we have been exposing and challenging these practices through litigation and public awareness, as well as advocacy with judges, and there have been really optimistic moves for reform by state court administrators, city leaders, who get that these practices are unfairly punitive and create this racially skewed two-tiered system of justice.
All right,
last month in Michigan, the Supreme Court amended its rules to help prevent failure to pay, leading people to being jailed. And the city of Biloxi has adopted sweeping reforms that provide a model for local governments on how to not criminalize the poor.
All right, Nusrat, real quick, where can people find out more about what the ACLU is doing and about this whole situation?
ACLU.org is our website, and if you search for Ending Modern Day Debtors Prisons at ACLU.org, you will find where we're working on this issue across the country.
All right, I want to thank both of you folks. Prachi, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having
me. And Nusrat, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, take care now. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we were just talking with Prachi Dave, the staff attorney of the ACLU at Washington State, and with Nusrat Chowdhury, the staff attorney for the ACLU located in New York, and we've been talking about debtors' prisons. All right, and this has been a very interesting show, and I hope you're going to be chewing on a lot of material for thought now. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I want to thank my production assistants, Jeff Pryor and Matt Quiklinski. And I also want to thank my board op for today, my engineer, Teddy Robinson. Great to have you back, Teddy. And each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out now with Outer National and We Are All Illegals.
Legales. Our time has come. Todos somos ilegales.